I'll call to order a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, April 27, 2007. This is our 8 a.m. agenda. We had closed our 7 a.m. agenda previously, and I appreciate the energy of our committee and doing back-to-back meetings here this morning. Describe what's going to happen. We have quite a long agenda, although there's some items that will be carried over. The work session on House Bill 2740 will be carried over until Monday, so that will not happen today.
What number?
2740.
Thank you.
We will be holding a work session on 3336. Public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2890 will be rolled over until Monday, so we will not be hearing House Bill 2890 today. Rolled over until Monday. And then we will be proceeding through the remaining work sessions, but we will be holding a public hearing, breaking it at some point when Representative Flores returns to hold the public hearing on House Bill 3318. But otherwise, we'll be proceeding through the work sessions that are listed on this agenda in roughly the order in which they appear here. So with that, I will open the work session on House Bill 3336. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16, which is in Benton County. And would it be okay if Mary Williams from the Department of Justice joined me?
That would be fine.
Here?
Which one is he on?
3336.
You should have before you today the Dash 6 amendments, and this might not happen very often, but we have brokered somewhat of a consensus around a death penalty bill. And what this changes, if you'll remember, we came and talked to you previously, and there was prescribed a method for determining whether or not a person had mental retardation. There were a lot of questions about that. So what the Dash 6 amendments do, it acknowledges that the United States Supreme Court has clarified that states may not impose or carry out a death penalty on certain defendants who are mentally retarded. And it goes on to reflect that the Supreme Court has provided very little guidance in terms of implementing this clarification. And as a result, in Section 2, you will see the creation of a task force on mental retardation in capital cases. It would be a four-member task force appointed by the governor that would include one member from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, one member from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, one member from the Oregon Advocacy Center, that is the group that advocates for people with disabilities, and one member from the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice would serve as the chair of this. And then it's listed the many kinds of questions that this task force is supposed to address to bring back by October 1st of 2008 to the Interim Judiciary Committee recommendations for policy choices the legislature may make to help district attorneys and criminal defense attorneys as they're dealing with these issues so that they don't have to litigate quite as many of them as they are right now. And Mary?
Mary Williams, Solicitor General for the Department of Justice. Just very briefly, I want to say that the Attorney General and the District Attorneys support the creation of this task force. This is a very important issue. There are a number of complexities involved, and we think that with the task force, we'll be able to reach some consensus on some of these issues and at least come to some proposals for the legislature to consider on the issues that we can't reach agreement. The Attorney General is happy to staff it and has agreed to absorb the cost of staffing the task force so that there would not be a fiscal on the bill.
Cameron, is everybody at the Dash 6s?
Yeah, that's what
actually, they're being distributed now.
Okay.
Yeah, if we could slow down a minute so we get the Dash 6s a little bit.
Dash 6s replace all the others.
I don't know. We're all looking for them.
Yeah, it's
yes.
It's a gut, complete gut and stuff.
It's a gut and stuff.
So without the Dash 6s, you won't be informed about what's happening here. While we're waiting for the text to come, Representative Gelser, would it be helpful for you to describe to the committee the process you've gone through in working this bill? Because I know you've put a lot of time and energy into it, and the players who are engaged in that.
Sure. To the best of my ability, I'd be happy to do that. As I described before, the original 3336 when I worked with legislative counsel to have it drafted, we used the article of the kind of the survey of states in terms of how they had implemented the Atkins decision. As well, prior to the Atkins decision, many states already, as a matter of policy, had indicated in their state statutes that they excluded people with mental retardation from eligibility from the death penalty. However, there were many questions from everybody that was involved, the criminal defense attorneys, district attorneys association, the ACLU, about some of the provisions in the original bill of 3336. One of those questions was about whether the determination of mental retardation should be made by a judge or by a jury. For advocates for people with mental retardation, there was a concern that if a jury made the determination of mental retardation after they'd heard the heinous facts of a crime, that could pollute the ability to make a decision, basically a factual decision about a medical condition. However, the ACLU pointed out that there's a right to a jury trial. The district attorneys pointed out that it could create an issue of two bites at the apple, and the criminal defense attorneys wanted to be sure that in the penalty phase as a in terms of extenuating circumstances?
Mitigating
circumstances. I'm a Human Services Committee member, not a Judiciary Committee member. That they wanted to be able to bring up those issues. The Department of Justice has been extremely helpful in this and actually has crafted a lot of the language that has gone into this amendment. They've worked closely with the District Attorneys Association since that time. I've also met with the Defense Attorneys Association, and they were better able to help me understand why the defense attorneys didn't like the idea of a pretrial determination by a judge. And it just became clear to me that it was not possible to broker a compromise on the answers to all of these complex questions without a task force. And the advocates are also comfortable with this. And for me, this is a question that has stalled over the course of several legislative sessions. I think that having a task force so that we can come back and finally have the legislature offer some guidance to those in the field would be helpful, and that's something that's been expressed to me from the Attorney General's.
That's right. That is consistent with the Attorney General's position on this as well.
And Ms. Williams, is this then, with the Dash 6 amendments, this is a consensus product among DOJ, the district attorneys, and other stakeholders in the process?
That's correct, Chairman Pearson.
Can I ask who participated in the work group for the Dash 6s?
Madam Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, there was not a formal work group that worked on this. I met shortly after the meeting with the Attorney General's office. Information was circulated. I met with the Criminal Defense Attorneys Association, continued to meet with the Oregon Advocacy Center, and there's been a lot of shuttle diplomacy. These amendments were written last night at about 5:20 p.m. and is the latest iteration. There has not been a point where all of these people have sat down around a table.
Very good. Any, now that you have the language in front of you, committee, you can see the membership of the task force that's being created.
There's no fiscal here, is what we're hearing, the agency's absorbing it.
Good question, Ms. Williams.
Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, the Attorney General has looked at the fiscal impact and has determined that we would be able to absorb the cost of staffing this task force.
Any further questions? Representative Cohn?
Are you ready for a motion?
I believe we are.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 6s into House Bill 3336.
Representative Kopp moves the Dash 6 amendments into House Bill 3336. Any discussion? Any objection? And the Dash 6 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3336 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kopp moves House Bill 3336 as amended by the Dash 6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Excuse me.
Vice Chair Wisnik.
Aye.
Chairman Ferguson.
Aye.
House Bill 3336, as amended, moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Representative Kelster, would you carry that bill on the floor?
I would be very happy to carry the bill on the floor.
Thank you for your work on this issue. Close the work session on House Bill 3336. And we will now go to the public hearing on House Bill 3318. I'm sorry. I thought you were back already. I beg your pardon. We will, we close the public hearing on 3318.
I'll be back.
when President Flores, I'm sorry, I thought you had gone and come back again. So we will move further down the agenda as described earlier. Open a work session on House Bill 2144.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2144 was originally heard by this committee on January the 17th. It comes to you from the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. What it does is it expands an existing crime of endangering the welfare of a minor to include allowing a minor to remain in the presence of illegal alcohol-related activity. Present ORS 163.5751B provides that a person commits the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor if the person knowingly allows a minor to enter or remain in a place where unlawful activity involving controlled substances is maintained or conducted. Essentially, that's drug house with kids around. House Bill 2144 adds the phrase "or alcohol" to the above law. Thus, the unlawful activity that could give rise to the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor could involve controlled substances, drugs, or alcohol. Endangering the welfare of a minor is a Class A misdemeanor. It also counts as a one-half person felony crime for purposes of determining an individual's placement on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission sentencing guidelines grid. Two of these half-person felonies would equal a person felony. It would move a person up the grid a ways. That's House Bill 2144.
Are there any amendments on this?
No.
Okay. I have a question of counsel. I seem to recall that when we heard this before, and we heard a lot of bills, similar bills, that there was a situation posed if you had, for example, a 20-and-a-half-year-old and he was having a beer at home with his 19-year-old brother, he'd be breaking the law.
Representative Bonamici, yes.
Mr. Chair, my concern, we talked, and I talked to the Restaurant Association, they didn't offer any solution for me, but I've stepped in a bar to watch a basketball game or something, and I had my minor kid with me, and, or I went in there to do it, and I was informed or something, but this says you enter it. I mean, it doesn't say, and I understand, hopefully people use some reason that you went in and didn't know the rule or didn't, you were traveling across the country or something like that. But it says enter, it's sort of a, you can't vote against, N21, sort of thing, but there's some.
There may be sensitivity about not moving forward with the bill, but these do raise policy choices. What I would say is House Bill 2144 should be considered probably in context along with the next bill, 2152. These are a couple of bills that came to us, as you may recall, from the Underage Drinking Task Force. And we did move four of the nine bills that were introduced in that task force's work. But these are two that they wanted us to come back and focus some attention on. Representative Krieger.
I was thinking, they put it in the section and they included in illegal drug activity. The drugs are illegal. Alcohol in itself isn't illegal. And so I've got a little bit of a problem what that might cause to happen. And it says to remain in the presence. What if you're at a city park? You're there first, sit down, have your lunch, and here comes a bunch of drunk young guys, and they sit down next to you. You got to pack up and leave. It's not written right. Sorry. It's going to include a whole lot of people and subject them, and I think it could maybe be written right, but now it is. It's going to open the door for totally unintended circumstances to come in.
Mr. Schrader, why don't you come in? Offer some input.
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, Philip Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. And I, at the outset here, I want to thank you for all the consideration you've given to the underage drinking task force bills. This bill actually is much narrower, I think, than Representative Krieger, your concerns are being expressed about. It requires both knowing and then permission to enter or remain. And permit means that you need to have authority and control over the circumstance and situation so that it doesn't apply to something that would be where somebody came down and sat next to you and you had no control over that circumstance. It is the same language appears in a different statute that has been interpreted by the Oregon Court of Appeals to require both knowing, which is an intentional act, and then also the permission part of it being that you have to have authority over the premises or over the actions of the individual. And the third piece of that is it's unlawful activity. It is not, so if you had a minor who was in your presence as you were drinking an alcoholic beverage, that's not unlawful activity. This is intended to get at where, you know, right now the furnishing statutes and other statutes don't apply to a circumstance where a minor child is authorized by their parent to go next door to engage in an underage drinking party, or an adult has rural farm property that they host, but they aren't present, they host drinking parties. And none of the current statutes get at that. And that was the intent behind this proposal, was to reach current circumstances that are not covered under the current statutes. So it has many limitations to it, the knowing, the permitting, and the unlawful activity.
Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about the breadth of how this could be interpreted, and I share Representative Krieger's and Representative Wisnett's concerns about that. I'm just expressing that. I understand that the statute says knowingly and unlawful activity, but I think it could be narrower.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the, thank you, Mr. Chair, the line 10 where alcohol liquor is maintained or conducted, and I'm just thinking of minor posted areas, and there, it just comes to my mind that there's some places that reverse their hours and allow minors at certain times, and then it'll say after 9 to midnight, minors not permitted. And yet there's still liquor probably in some cupboards or in some area. I don't know. I understand the purpose of this bill from what we're hearing is to people who are intentionally, come on in here while we get drunk type thing and sit with us. But I would be concerned about a little bit of the language of maybe we change that to minor posted area. Because there might be liquor, but it might be legal for the minor to be in there at a certain time. Maintained. Liquor maintained in a facility.
Well, Chairman Pearson, let me make this offer. If the committee isn't prepared to move forward, I'd be, interested in working with either members of the committee or council or other interested parties to come at this problem from a different direction, potentially. I continue to think this is a good approach, but if the committee isn't prepared to go forward with it, I'd like to certainly not lose it off the radar screen of the assembly.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I'd like to make a comment that, being a country girl, this is a huge problem. It's amazing how one comment made at lunch at noon in a high school can evolve into a minimum of a 50 to 150 member party in minutes, and there's no way to control that, deal with it. I would be more than willing to work with the district attorney's office, the attorney general, to look at how we can define that, clarify it, whatever we need to do, because this is a problem.
Okay.
what committee, as I mentioned before, we have this bill and the one following as sort of the remaining portions of the work of the Underage Drinking Task Force, and there's, I think, some concern raised by this one here. I think what I'd like to do is to open the following work session as well so we can get the discussion of those maybe two going together. So I'm going to open work session on House Bill 2152. Mr. Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Again, this bill, 2152, was originally heard January 17th and comes to you from the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. House Bill 2152 relates to the automatic suspension of driving privileges of minors upon citations for alcohol. Present ORS 471.430 provides that alcohol offenses by underage person, that would possession, attempted possession of alcohol, entry into bars or certain clubs, is a Class B violation punishable by a fine and perhaps treatment, community service. House Bill 2152 adds an additional penalty for such offenses, the automatic administrative suspension of driving privileges for offenders between ages 15 and 20. The arresting officer would provide notice of this suspension at the time of the citation and would also seize the offender's license, even if it's an out-of-state license. The officer would then issue a temporary driving permit that would be valid for the next 30 days to the offender. If the offender wishes to appeal the suspension, the offender has 10 days to file written notice with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Oregon Department of Transportation must hear this appeal within 30 days. If the appeal is unsuccessful, the suspension then would first become valid on the 31st day after the citation. So the license would not be suspended immediately. It would be suspended after the 31st day after the citation. Judicial review of the administrative appeal is available. The length of the suspension is 90 days for first offenders and then a year for any repeat offenders. An offender may obtain temporary hardship emergency driving permits in certain situations. To cover the cost of administering the program, ODOT is authorized to charge fees in connection with reinstating an offender's privileges. And I should note, just for full information, you should have in your packets, I just saw there is a note or letters, it's a stapled packet at the back from judges. Terry Legert, Circuit Judge in Marion County, and Mary Souther Wyatt and Nan Waller, who are family law judges in Multnomah County, and Deanne Darling, who is, I believe, Clackamas County juvenile judge, regarding this bill.
Are there extra copies of that? Because I only have the Terry Liger.
I think they're all stapled together. Maybe, look, you just have the Liger one? And those letters, which they express concerns about 2152.
Chair. Quick clarifying question for counsel. Thank you. The staff manager summary says this would be in place for offenders between ages of 15 and 20. Does it also go up to 21?
Representative Reed, I don't believe so. It would just be for those who, because it's in connection with MIP offenses.
So, 21, they would be of age.
Right. But so between 20 and 21, it would be in effect, though, correct?
Oh, correct. Right.
Okay.
Thank you. I see your point. Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you. I can vote for this. If anything, we had the testimony before. I didn't think it went far enough. I thought after the second or third minor in possession, they should lose their license up to 21 or something. But I can vote for the bill, but I think we should have been even tougher.
Chair, Representative Krieger.
It talks about authorized temporary driver's permit and hardship permits. What is the length of those? Let's say the person is full-time employed and they got an hour drive to and from work. So is there any permanency, a permanent license to get to and from work? I don't see it. The other thing we talked about last time was we always tell people that if you're going to drink, don't drive, have a designated driver. So if they're not at all the offense of MIP, I agree. That's just playing an offense. Then you relate it to their driving. The two are not connected unless you do them. And so here you're penalizing someone for doing the very thing that you might be telling them to do as an adult, and that's not drink and drive. they may have made a conscientious choice. They're going to go up some road or out to a lake, and they're going to drink, and then they're going to stay there and go home the next day. Or they may even be, you know, someplace totally unrelated with driving.
I already had concerns about this bill, and now I have further concerns after reading, for example, Judge Legert's letter here, making the very good point about what happens to insurance rates and how this would disproportionately affect low-income people. For example, the example that's given in here is that says my farmer's insurance agent told me that a 16-year-old male who wants liability insurance, it costs $1,363 a year. As a parent who has two teenage drivers right now, I know insurance costs are really high. But if this youth had a license suspension, it would go up to $2,400 a year. And I'm just trying to figure out how it works if there's this automatic suspension, what that does to insurance rates without any regard to culpability and a determination of culpability. And I was trying to imagine, say, for example, I drove the car that my teenagers drive to the grocery store and I accidentally left a six-pack. I don't drink beer, but say, for example, I accidentally left a six-pack beer in the trunk and then one of my teenagers was driving the car and got pulled over. They automatically have their license suspended. And that seems to me to not get at, create a whole slew of problems that doesn't really get at the real issue, which is teenage driving. So I really have concerns. I think my concerns are exacerbated by sitting here and reading these letters from judges who have worked with underage drinking and are urging us to take a different approach. So I acknowledge that there's a problem, most seriously, there is a problem. But whether this automatic suspension is the way to get at it without having a determination of guilt or innocence before the suspension very much concerns me. And I also, one more thing, am not sure where this determination gets made. I think it's going to go through the Department of Transportation. Rather than through the court system, and I'm not sure that's a good thing to require, whether it's through the DMV or the DOT, to be adjudicating this without the court system involved. I'm just not convinced that that's the right approach either.
Captain Krieger, had you read all of this from the courts ahead of time? I hadn't seen it.
This is new material. I understood it was coming.
I just was glancing through. I mean, there's numerous things in here that would persuade me that this is not the right thing to do at this time. Whether they could fix it by Monday, I don't know.
Let's have Mr. Schradl come forward so he can give us some further input on this. And Mr. Schradl, have you seen the materials that the judges sent?
What are you looking at?
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, Phil Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. First, no, I haven't seen the letter. And I tried to engage in conversation, but that didn't occur beforehand. But want to address just a couple of things that have been raised. One is that the reason for this proposal is that the current system simply isn't working. The statistics are that 30% of 8th graders are drinking and 50% of 11th graders are drinking. The current system is not having the right effect on the behavior. This is presented as an alternative. It doesn't, and for Representative Bonamici's question, it doesn't have an automatic suspension. What happens is that if a citation is issued to the minor with minor in possession allegation, if they want to contest that, they have the opportunity, full opportunity, to have a contested case proceeding before the administrative hearing panel, the Office of Administrative Hearings. And the suspension won't go into effect unless and until a determination is made that they actually did violate the MIT statutes. And so there's, you know, it's full protection in terms of there isn't going to be an automatic suspension merely on the issuance of the citation if that citation is challenged at all. And then I have Ms. Young from DMV here who can address the question about the length of hardship permits and emergency permits.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this is Lorna Youngs, Administrator of the DMV. This law is patterned very similar to the implied consent law, where you have an administrative suspension in parallel with the court proceedings for violation of alcohol-related laws. So much of the language that you see in here is very similar to the implied consent laws that are currently working. As far as hardship permits go, hardship permits are allowed for individuals who are suspended within after the first 30 days of the suspension. The hardship permit is a permit that gives them a specific route and specific times to go to work and to take care of treatment or other emergency family businesses that they may need to take care of. So it specifically allows for work and treatment and other essential activities.
Okay. Any questions for these or
other? Just a statement. And Representative Bonamici mentioned about a six-pack of beer in the trunk. I'm sure that if the officer made your daughter open the trunk, he'd probably have illegal seats and surgery. I think that this is something that we ought to really take a strong look at. And I know having two teenage daughters that have gone through those years and probably made some mistakes, knowing that their license would be suspended if they were doing illegal activity that they shouldn't be doing in the first place, I think is a good thing. And my concern about a lot of the minor drinking things that we've been doing is we're trying to attack the distributors, we're trying to attack the people that are selling to them and put all the penalties on it. And this is one of those that would put penalties back where it belongs, of the youth in our society that maybe don't have respect for the laws or the authority that we're putting over them.
Richard Krieger.
Sure, I want to read one part out of here. It says, the task force stated in its report, Oregon's underage drinking laws are already quite strong. In many ways, they are among the strongest in the country. Task force report, page 5. I agree and believe these laws are doing what the law says and are intended to do. However, the task force reports that the reason for changing the statute and taking this judicial discretion away is because there's a lack of uniformity statewide when it comes to enforcing these laws. And then she goes on to that.
Representative Kump.
Representative Krieger is kind of hitting the point. I was going to ask the question, is, did you do comparison with our sister states, Washington, Idaho, and California? Again, as these people, all of our children are very mobile. As they cross state lines, would there be a different criteria in Washington if you're in Portland and just crossing over the bridge?
Chair McPherson, Representative Kump. In terms of comparison, the statistical figures in Oregon are that underage drinker is a higher rate of underage drinking in Oregon than the national average. Now, in terms of what statutes may apply in other states, I don't know the answer to that in terms of what their statutory structure might look like. The purpose behind the task force, we agree that the statutory scheme in Oregon is a strong one, but the difficulty is that it doesn't get adequately enforced for whatever reasons. The statistical information is very inconsistent across the state, whether that's resource-driven or whatever else. And the statistical information that the task force looked at shows that swift and sure consequences are exactly the driver that changes behavior for underage drinkers, and that's why we came forward with this proposal.
Just a follow-up comment, Chair, and I'll be brief. In some of my research about students in school attendance, I assure you there are a number of states, less than 10, but several, that if you skip school often enough, they pull your driver's license in order to get the students' attention. So this is a strategy being used for a range of reasons.
Thank you. Mr. Schrader, can you talk about what consequences there are now for a minor in possession? Isn't it already in the law that their license can be suspended?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, yes, that's true. If they get engaged in the judicial system all the way through to getting to where the court would call for that sanction to be imposed, yes, it is available. But the statistical information that we've showed the committee members, I think, is that, for example, in Multnomah County, 77% of people who are cited for MIP simply get a warning. Nothing else occurs within the current system. And now I think that's a resource-driven problem, that the resources aren't there to address it. And what this alternative does is provide a very, it's a cheaper and more, and a quicker and a more efficient way of getting at enforcement of the minor in possession statutes as they currently exist.
Committee, what I'm going to suggest on both these bills, which we're open in work session, House Bill 2144 and 2152, since it's been some months even and since these were last before us and we had a chance to air these issues, and I sense that there may not be sufficient support within the committee to act on them, to move them today, that we roll them over until our Monday agenda, which would give a chance for people to reflect on these further and for Mr. Schradl to determine whether there's sufficient support for one or both of these bills here for movement on Monday. So I will, if there's no concern about that, Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, and I do apologize. Thank you for your indulgence because I was testifying in another committee. But I do have some indication from judges in my district that they are, at Clackamas County, very much, I guess the term is, strongly opposed to House Bill 2152. So there is significant concern, I think, that needs to be examined.
And I encourage people to look through the other judges' letters that came in because the juvenile judges are, several of them are very concerned.
And they're very credible judges, a couple of them. Worked with youth a long time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to close the work session on House Bills 2144 and 2152 and open a work session on House Bill 2179.
House Bill 2179 has been before the committee on January 25th and then again on March the 15th. It relates to the Department of Human Services and their ability to obtain criminal background information. ORS 181.557 provides a mechanism for a designated agency to obtain criminal background information from the Oregon State Police regarding individuals seeking agency employment or licensing or for some other permissible agency purposes. In short, present rules require that the requesting agency either provide prior written consent from the individual for such a criminal background check or provide proof that the agency gave written notice to the individual that the agency might request a criminal background check. There are presently no exceptions to these requirements. House Bill 2179 amends ORS 181-557 by providing for such an exception for one agency. It allows the Department of Human Services to obtain criminal background information regarding an individual without prior written consent or notice if that individual is the subject of a child abuse or neglect complaint or if the individual resides at or frequents the residence of an alleged child abuse victim. In addition, that's all I'll say for now. There are two amendments, the Dash 1 and the Dash 2. And the Dash 2 specifies that the Department of Human Services must always notify the subject of the criminal record check. In the original bill, it said we only have to DHS only needs to notify if there's an actual investigation. The Dash 2 clarifies that, no, you need to notify the person always if there was a criminal record check. The Dash 1, which I believe is also under consideration today, deletes section 2 of the present bill. Effectively, what this means is that the legislature continues to opt out of a federal standard relating to foster care and adoption assistance. But it's my understanding that they need to specifically state so that they're opting out in order to continue to receive federal funding.
Council, I have a Dash 1 amendment.
No, Dash 2.
Do people have a Dash 2?
No.
Oh, wait, I do have it. Here, flip in the back there.
Mr. Chair, I'm not finding Dash 2 in my...
I found them in my bill file clipped to the back of this page here.
This is not an official...
No, but I had attached in the back of it.
Yeah, I had that.
I think my...
I had that too, but not the amendment. I have two Dash 1s. That would be a 2. I have 3 Dash 1s.
Add that 2 Dash 1s.
Therefore, I have a Dash 2.
That was Florence's comment.
Not mine.
1 plus 1 plus 1.
I won't
have
credit
for it. You don't have a Dash 2 or
full attributes?
4 Dash 1s.
No, you had me only get 3 of them. I might have to work 7 or something as well.
Okay. I'm alerted that there may be concerns about the dash twos, and maybe they're not quite in shape to work with. So what I'm going to do is close the work session on House Bill 2179, roll that over to Monday, which gives a little more time to try and make sure that things are in the right shape. So,
Mr. Chair, just before you do that, just a technical question. I noticed the dash ones are actually deleting part of the relating clause. Is that an appropriate amendment, changing a relating clause?
It doesn't change what it's relating to. It only changes the creating new provisions and what
only
statute.
Only the first phrase.
So we're okay.
All right. Clause.
Just want to make sure.
And that is good to be alert to that, because that's the one thing that cannot be changed in our bill. Okay. I will then close the work session on House Bill 2179 and open a work session on House Bill 2303.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2303 was before the committee on January 26th, and then again today. It relates generally to a court's ability to reduce the amount of fines for violations. I'll talk about the original bill, then there are two amendments under consideration today, the dash one and then the dash three. What ORS 153.093 limits a court's ability to reduce the amount of fines for violations. For most violations, a court cannot go below 75% of the base fine amount. The statutes prescribe a formula for calculating this base fine amount. The base fine amount for a Class A violation, for example, is $427. Thus, the lowest fine that a court could impose for a Class A violation is $320.25. House Bill 2303 provides courts with additional authority to reduce fines for violation. First, it changes 75% to 50%. A court thus could reduce a fine to 50% of the base fine amount. It then provides that a court can go below 50% of the base fine if the court finds any one of the following. One, for vehicle equipment violations, that the accused has installed or repaired the required equipment. Two, that the accused has not been convicted of an offense for the preceding 3 years. Three, that the defendant is indigent. Or four, that the 50% base fine amount is, quote, inconsistent with justice, close quote. House Bill 2303 purports to apply to violations committed before, on, or after the effective date. The Dash 1 amendment also allows for changes in existing law, but it does only one thing. It allows a court to reduce the base fine amount from 75% to 50%. That's it. All the other language about vehicle equipment violations, that they haven't been convicted of an offense for 3 years, the defendant's indigent, or that it's inconsistent with justice, all that is stricken. So it's just 75%. You can go all the way down to 50%. That's the dash one. The dash three amendment is the same as the original bill, but what it does, it amends a statute relating to search warrants, ORS 133.575. It's not exactly relevant to the bill itself, but it fits within the relating clause. My understanding is that this is a consensus amendment that folks with Department of Justice and I believe criminal defense persons as well have agreed. I see Ms. Christian nodding her head. Thank you. That it is a necessary change. It amends ORS 133.575 to state that a search warrant that authorizes the seizure of items from a corporation may be executed in the manner provided by ORCP 7. That's what that change does. So that's the dash 3 amendment.
So, committee, we have really two things that are kind of linked here, joined because of a relating clause. We have the original concept of the bill, which was to increase the authority of the court to reduce fines for violations. And then we have a dash three amendment, which is happens to fit within the relating clause, and which is a consensus product, we're understanding, that on a technical point. So one of them raises a policy set of choices or considerations, and the other is a simply a housekeeping matter. does anyone need to hear anything more about the dash three amendments than what you heard from counsel? So I'm sure we have people in the room who could explain that more fully. So
no, I'm just wondering, the dash one amendments are from.
The dash one amendments, actually, I suggested they be prepared after our hearing on this bill some weeks ago, which would, instead of the original printed bill, which would have gone from 100% to 0%, it would have retained a 50% as a threshold amount, so that we wouldn't have the widest range of discretion being exercised, there'd still be a baseline if a person was pled guilty to an offense, but it would expand the latitude that the judge could exercise.
Mr. Chair, have we had any comment from sponsors of the bill or the people that are drafting it regarding the Dash 1?
I don't know that I've heard comments, but I think Representative Olson was involved with the bill here originally.
Yes.
So, Representative, you wanted this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy Olson, State Representative from the Albany area, had the opportunity to review all three of the amendments. Personally, bottom line, I would prefer not to go with the Dash 1s, but I can work with that. And it would be an interesting compromise. Most definitely am extremely supportive of the Dash 3s into the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Could, Mr. Chair, I didn't catch, I didn't understand, again, it's still early enough. Your concern about the Dash 1, why that was going to do to us and what... It's going to say 50%. There's no, you can't go below that. Is that what you're saying?
Right. That we retain as a threshold of 50%. That if somebody pled guilty to a violation, then there'd be the judge could exercise discretion to go down to half of that amount.
I think the concern of the committee and the reason we're doing this and talking to the judges is, you know, they want, you know, some discretion so we don't, you know, people that can't afford it and still need to, you know, be considered. I would leave it up. We're going to reduce it. Let's leave it to the judges completely, not give them another barrier or bar.
Representative Krieger?
I think we heard testimony. I can attest to it myself. There were times when, yeah, there was a violation. But you got, you know, the person in the small communities, you got a single mom with two kids, and you're going to give her a $400 ticket. There's no way for her to, I mean, somebody's not going to get something they need now, you know. You got to remember, I'm not exactly a soft-on-crime guy. I come from the background where I used to hand those little things out, you know. See you next week. But I'm trying to find a way, Mr. Chair, how you make it where there's justice and fairness. And because these are violations, they're not crimes against people where people are hurt normally. It's one of the places I'd be willing to give the judges the discretion, and I think it would fit. That's where I am with the original bill.
Okay. Any further comments or discussion?
I would join the representative in opposing Dash 1.
Okay.
Are you looking for a motion or?
Well, I'm actually looking for reactions.
I'd love to give you a reaction.
One of the things that I like about this process, and as you may have noticed, there are many times when I don't know where people are, and I think the process works well when we have a policy choice before us, and we just debate it out here in front of the people of Oregon, and they can see where we are.
Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate your role you've played this whole time doing that too, and I have to apologize because I was rude and left the room, and I didn't listen to what the Dash 1s did versus the Dash 6s, so that's why you're getting silenced.
No, that's fine. And I tell you what the policy choice is if it would be helpful.
What I understand, let me explain what I understand the policy. If we adopt Dash 1s, we limit the judges to reduce it to 50%. If we adopt the Dash 3s, we allow the judges to do anything they want to do.
And the one thing I would urge you to recognize is that those fines go someplace. There are streams of revenue that support important functions that have been chosen as made policy choices. And I can't recite what all those are because they tend to get divided up in several different places. And when we decide that we're going to go from 100% to zero, then we are then putting those the fines that go in to support important public functions in completely at the discretion of the judges. I think our judges should have discretion. I guess the question is, should they have a zero you know, from 100% to 0%, as opposed to being able to knock it in half. And that's a lot of discretion.
And I, when I said my made my comments, obviously I got a rise from my peer from Albany here, and he wanted to respond to what I said.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Andy Olson again from state, from Albany. No, I'm not. I'm not responding to you, Representative Cameron. So, I just wanted to kind of, maybe it might help a little bit. The portion that of the entire bill that's identified with the portion that would be removed as a result of the amendment dash one amendments. It's consistent with that language that does exist right now in the bill for the total bill. It would be consistent with that of what the Supreme Court has done with indigent cases. I mean, there's so much case law with that. And I guess, you know, realizing that this is only traffic, you know, just violations and that type of thing. To me, and I understand what you're saying and your argument and everything, this would be a good, to me, I believe that this would be a good move to give discretion back to the courts to some degree with this, considering where we're at in our state today with a lot of cases. So.
I actually like the language in the original bill because it sets out some things that should be considered and for the when the judge is deciding whether to reduce the fine, and it includes whether, you know, indigence and prior background, and I think that I like that language in there to give the court that discretion.
Let me understand. Is there something that the last ones were deleting by way of standards for exercise of discretion?
Yes. The dash ones, Mr. Chair, the dash ones would, right now under existing law, it's 75% of the base fine. That's the judge's discretion. That's existing law. That's how low they can take it. The dash ones say rather than 75% of the base fine, you can go all the way down to 50% of the base fine, and that's it. That's what the dash ones say. The bill says you can go to 50% of the base fine, and you can also ignore that 50% of the base fine if you find any one of the following. Ah. That any one of the following language is not in the dash one.
So what's wrong with the original bill? So, I mean, in response to Representative Bonamici's point, if you like those standards, those could be applied to the adjustment from down to 50%. The standards. Well, no, but the question is, will there be a 50% threshold retained?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Flores.
In discussions on other matters where we've had consensus amendments, I've heard members of this committee express support for when something is brought to us as a matter of consensus. Groups having come together, mm-hmm. vetted their aired their issues, and developed a product to bring to us that has their mutual concurrence. I think what I heard counsel say is these dash threes are a gut and stuff for the original bill. They are consensus amendments and involve some necessary changes to the very statutes. I think that's what we have to consider here, as we have had the interested parties come together, work on this issue, and bring us a consensus piece.
Well, the dash three amendments are a consensus amendment on something that's unrelated to the question of fines for violations. So
yes,
we have two separate things going on. The dash threes are a consensus product, and the issue of the dash ones goes to the initial policy choice presented by the original bill.
Chairman, here's a member of the committee. My name is Michael Slauson from the Department of Justice. Maybe I could just kind of briefly explain what the dash three amendments do to kind of clear up any ambiguity. They don't relate to the original bill. It's, as the chair pointed out, it's a technical change to the search warrant statute that currently requires execution of search warrant by police officers, which is impractical when you're dealing with big corporations. You know, for instance, if we wanted to get the email content of communications from the business Yahoo in California, there's no way for an Oregon police officer to execute that search warrant in Yahoo. So what this would do is allow you to serve the search warrant on the corporation's representative and allow the corporation itself to do the search. That makes sense when the corporation's not the subject of the criminal investigation. Current law already provides for that for banks and for bank records. So it's unrelated.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Chair, then I was correct in assuming that dash threes are fine and we're trying to determine if we're going to move dash ones?
The policy issue before us is whether we put the dash ones in the bill or not.
And let's be clear about one thing, though, if I may, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Slauson explained the dash threes. That's one of the changes in the dash three. But the dash three also, it's not a gut and stuff. It attaches itself to the original bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron.
I'm clear now. Sorry for not, but my support is for the bill as it was originally written, because that does allow, I think, in Representative Krieger's standpoint of him to cite a person for a taillight out and for the judge to totally make that go away, and it allows a police officer to enforce and then the judges to do that. Otherwise, he might not write the citation. So there are some exemptions in there that they could go below the 50%, and I would support that, giving our judges a little bit of leeway on some of those things. So now I understand.
Say, Mr. Chair, that you talk about the revenue, you're going to see more citations written because they know there's going to be some discretion allowed. And I think, I believe Representative Barker spoke to that here when he was here. So I would support the original bill on dash three.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I, too, after all the dialogue, I like the original bill. In fact, I finally found it at the bottom of my packet in my notes that I like this bill as stated. So.
Okay. Well, committee, I recognize that I am not in the majority perspective on this bill. I would have to say, I would, if it weren't, we will bring this to a vote because that's the sense of the committee, and I think that I want to make sure that my committee has an opportunity to move a policy choice that they prefer forward. If we didn't have a necessary cleanup, I would vote against this bill because to have a standard that goes down to zero on a standard as vague as would be inconsistent with justice is being, I think, so really so loose with our traffic violation laws that and those fines go to good and important places. And we have made policy choices about where they go, and there are streams of revenue that depend upon those violations. But with hearing the sense of the committee, I'm not going to advance the dash ones, and I'm open for a motion on the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, and I heard your about the justice issue, and if we can't rely on our judges to establish what that might be in a given circumstances, then we'll probably be back here again. Raising it up again, I think, that if we hear a lot of complaints that it's being abused.
Are you ready for a motion?
I am.
I'll move the dash threes into House Bill 2303.
Representative Krieger moves the dash ones into House Bill 23.
Threes.
I'm sorry, dash threes.
Oh, oh no!
The dash three amendments into House Bill 2303.
Oh, you're sorry.
Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objection? The dash three amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I will move House Bill 2303 with the dash threes to the floor with the two pass.
Representative Krieger moves the House Bill 2303 as amended by the dash three amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker. Excuse. Vice Chair
Whitman. Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2303, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 2303. And I'm now going to open a public hearing on
here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Olson, would you carry that, please? Very good. Then I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3318.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 3318 relates to State Board of Education's ability to commission certain public safety officers. ORS 352.385 allows the State Board of Higher Education to allow institutions under its control to designate persons as special campus security officers. There is a limit of no more than 50 such persons throughout the Oregon University system under present law. Special officers can stop and frisk and make arrests, but they cannot carry firearms, and they are not considered officers for purposes such as the public employee retirement system and life insurance. House Bill 3318 amends ORS 352.385 by removing the title Special Campus Security Officer. Such persons would become full public safety officers, undergo complete training by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. My understanding is that we have a dash one amendment for consideration today as well. Requires the State Board of Education, State Board of Higher Ed, to authorize each institution under its control to commission six or more of its employees as full public safety officers.
We'll bring up the first three people who signed up for a public hearing, Mr. Marks, Mr. Silver, and Mr. Anderson, please. Have one other, Mr. Collins, you want to join them? We can pull another chair up, please. I think they're all here to in support of the bill. Please begin your testimony by stating your name, please, for the record.
My name is Mike Silver. I am a public safety officer at Western Oregon University. However, I represent SEIU, Local 503, and over 3,500 members of Oregon. More specifically, I'm here to represent approximately 100 campus public safety officers across the state. First, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to testify at this hearing. The public safety officers across the state are increasingly running into violent offenders, people with guns, narcotics, street-level drug dealers, and dealing with more and more areas of actual law enforcement officer duties. Down at University of Oregon in March of 2006, two of our public safety officers almost lost their lives. I provided you with a statement from one of those officers who was unable to be here. We do have probable cause arrest authority. However, we are only required to have 8 hours of procedural law training per the ORS. So essentially, we can do the same job as any other police officer, except for we're only required to have 8 hours of procedural law training. That is not enough. With our officers' lives on the line, we are there to protect our property and the citizens of our universities, which essentially are larger than the cities we encompass. The opponents of this bill would like to say that firearms are a big issue for them. They don't want to see guns on campus. The guns are already there. People with concealed weapons permits, people that bring the guns on the campuses illegally, they're already there. Why not train our first responders, our officers that respond to these people? Why not train them and allow them the tools and the protections under the ORS to do their jobs? One of the other opponents would like to say, from our understanding, that this is going to cost OUS $2 million approximately to implement. Well, I took that number and I looked at the cost. If you take an Oregon State Trooper and a Eugene Police Department officer at step one, just line staff, not including supervision, not including vehicles, not including anything, just line staff salary alone, you're looking at $559,927.12 per year. And that is currently for the Oregon State Troopers that are at OSU as well as at University of Oregon. If House Bill 3318 is implemented, and you take the existing public safety officers up five pay ranges to the very top step of that fifth pay range, train them, certify them as police officers, you're looking at a total cost to OUS of $319,248. That's a savings of over $240,000 a year versus what they're paying in a contract right now to the Oregon State Police and Eugene Police Department. The Eugene Police Department right now is in favor of this bill. The Oregon State Police has taken a neutral stance on this bill. Logistics is another issue that our opponents would like to raise. they are of the opinion and of the feeling that it would be hard for us to communicate with the local jurisdictions, the police officers, the deputies. I don't understand that. We already do that. Some of our public safety officers are already on the same radio frequency as the local law enforcement agencies. We already work together. We have to call them on major crimes. It's already in place. We talk about having a law enforcement or an outside law enforcement agency on the campus. That's good enough. Two U of O public safety officers almost lost their lives on a campus where Eugene Police Department is stationed. That's not enough. The local agencies do not have access to our buildings. They do not know our campus communities like we do. We are the first responders. This bill would not only have every one of these public safety officers that the six per university campus, and those dollar figures are based on six per university campus, by the way. Not only will we become full police, we will have to meet the training requirements and the minimum requirements of DPSST to do that. So it's not like we're going to take our campus public safety officers, hand them a firearm, say, have a good day. They are going to receive the same training as any other police officer in the state of Oregon. The communities, our campus communities, have grown huge. We have, in some instances, over 20,000 people on a campus in a day. Budgets for outside agencies, as you know, everywhere, are hurting. The superintendent of the Oregon State Police is begging for troopers. These troopers at OSU could be reallocated to the road where they're needed most. The Eugene police officers can go back to their city where they are needed most. OUS is already paying for a law enforcement unit, even though we are not recognized as a law enforcement unit, on these campuses. We know the campuses. We know our people. We are only asking for the training and the abilities to service our campus communities. Thank you, and I can answer.
Let's do the whole panel. Thank you, Mr. Silver. Let's do the whole panel first, and we'll open up the questions. Who's next, please?
I am here, sir. Mr. Chairman, all representatives, my name is Greg Marks. I would like to thank you for allowing me to speak to the committee. I'm here representing myself as a private citizen of the state of Oregon, but will be drawing upon my experience as a public safety officer in the Oregon University System at Portland State University. House Bill 3318 will allow the commissioned public safety officers to receive the same training as a police officer in the state of Oregon. Currently, commissioned public safety officers are given 8 hours on probable cause arrest authority for DPS by DPSST under ORS 352-385. Commissioned public safety officers are given probable cause arrest authority, stop and frisk authority. Commissioned public safety officers are required by an opinion of the Attorney General's office to make arrests for warrants, domestic violence, and violations of restraining orders. Police officers are given 640 hours of certified training compared to the 8 hours commissioned public safety officers currently receive. DPSST does not certify commissioned public safety officers in the state of Oregon. House Bill 3318 would correct this. There is currently no requirement for commissioned public safety officers to continue to receive updated training, while certified police officers are mandated to receive a minimum of 84 hours of agency-approved training every 3 years. House Bill 3318 would correct this. The need for police services at Portland State University is not in question. Currently, the University of Oregon has a contract with Eugene Police Department, and the Oregon State University has a contract with Oregon State Police to provide police services on their campus. Unlike these other institutions in the Oregon University system, Portland State University does not have an expensive contract with the City of Portland Police Bureau to provide police services on campus. The university relies on their commissioned public safety officers to provide this service. Commissioned public safety officers at Portland State University currently provide a variety of police services, including the transport of prisoners to the Multnomah County Detention Center, Cooper Detox Center, and the Donald E. Long Juvenile Detention Center. Portland State University is truly an urban campus. There is no boundary marker that separates the university from the city, and as such, experience aspects of city life, good and not so good. Personally, as a public safety officer at Portland State University, I have responded to fatal and non-fatal vehicle accidents. fatal and non-fatal vehicle to pedestrian accidents, rapes and sexual assaults, assaults with weapons in progress, a stabbing in one of our residence halls, and a fight with a firearm in the street in front of one of our residence halls, burglaries in progress, attempted suicide, a marijuana growing operation in a residence hall where a loaded shotgun was also present in the room, domestic violence calls, fights in progress calls of up to 40 people fighting at once where we had to call in the city of Portland to assist us, and they sent 13 cars, driving under the influence, possession of controlled substance, distribution of controlled substance, and subjects in mental crisis. Recently, Portland State University Department of Public Safety had the University Office of Institution Research conduct a survey of staff, student, faculty, and ask them what kind of services the department provided. Attached to my testimony is also copies of this. The faculty and staff responded with 51.2% saying police services. The students responded with 50% saying police services. House Bill 3318 will allow the university to meet this expectation. Portland State University Department of Public Safety works very closely with the Portland Police Bureau on a daily basis. The Portland Police Bureau is Portland State University's Public Safety Department official records keeper, meaning all reports we generate are kept by the Portland Police Bureau's Records Division. Portland Police Bureau is also Portland State University's property and evidence custodian. Recently, Portland State University purchased 3 channels on the 800 megahertz trunking radio system that is maintained and operated by the City of Portland's Bureau of Emergency Communications, 911 for the City of Portland. This radio system links all the law enforcement in the metro area, enabling Portland State University's Public Safety Department to quickly and effectively communicate with them. It also links us with OHSU, which is on the 800 trunking system. Again, I would like to thank you for allowing me to speak before the committee, and we'd be pleased to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. I appreciate that you're not, you know, you're giving us some other good facts. It's not repeating, so I appreciate that. So who, Mr. Anderson or Mr. Collins, who's next?
Mr. Chairman, honorable representatives, thank you for letting me testify before you. My name is Michael Anderson. I'll represent myself as a private citizen. However, I will be drawing upon my experiences as a campus public safety officer at Portland State University. First of all, I'd like to echo the experiences that were brought forth by my colleague. However, I'm going to be attempting to concentrate on some information you haven't heard yet. Being the center of downtown Portland dictates that the number of calls we receive is quite high. Me personally, as the primary officer, has received 1,140 calls for service since June of 2006. In that time, I have completed 115 incident reports. That's actually low. That was from a few weeks ago when I wrote this testimony. Currently, Portland State University is staffed by 8 public safety officers and 2 administrators. That leaves us with 5 vacant positions. The reasons why we can't fill these positions are twofold. The considerable amount of ambiguity in the job of public safety officer and the lack of certified training and equipment necessary to perform the job effectively. Now I'd like to give you guys some personal stories here. I've personally been involved in at least 5 situations in which I felt the need to call the Portland Police Bureau for emergency assistance. In none of those situations did they arrive in time to give me effective assistance. In 2 of these situations, suspects escaped because I had to disengage for my own personal safety. One of these situations involved me being the lone officer on duty when I was called to the report of a vandalism. I spotted 2 subjects that matched the description of the suspects. I attempted to stop them, and they refused my lawful order to stop. I grabbed one of the suspects, and the other one came behind my back and grabbed me. I was able to free myself, and the suspects ran off. Portland police were called immediately, but did not dispatch out the call for more than 5 minutes. I did not pursue the suspects because it was obvious that it was going to require more than one officer to control them. Another situation involved Officer Marks and I being cut off from assistance from the Portland Police Bureau because we were inside of one of our locked residence halls. Those residence halls have restricted access to keys and electronic key cards. Basically, a suspect started struggling with us in an elevator and was throwing us up against the walls. Officer Marks yelled at one of our resident assistants repeatedly to go down to the lobby and let in the Portland Police Bureau. As you might expect, being somebody who rarely sees us, she froze up. It took several instances before she could get down to the lobby. Luckily, Officer Marks and I were able to effectively take this subject into custody. Only at that time did the Portland Police Bureau arrive. Additionally, public safety officers are routinely called to suicide attempts and fights with weapons, as Officer Marks said. I just want to give you one more story. Officer Marks and I were called to our university-owned hotel on a disturbance in a room. When we got there, we found out that the following quote had been heard: "Why don't I stab you?" Officer Marks and I, fearing that there would be weapons involved, were forced to call the Portland Police Bureau. It took 25 minutes for the Portland Police Bureau to get one car to the hotel. Luckily, it was simply two people fighting on the phone and not a dangerous situation. However, had it been, that could have ended fatally. I just want to remind you that our public safety officers are a special kind of officer. We're charged with taking care of everybody from the adults returning to school to students who are leaving their house for the first time.
This is not for the public. Earthquake drill, duck, cover, and hold.
You about to wrap.
Okay.
That'd be appreciative and respectful, huh?
Yeah, I feel we owe it to our campus communities to have trained officers with the necessary tools to keep them protected. I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I am happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much. I think Mr. Collins.
Morning. Chairman Ferguson and members of the committee, my name is Mike Collins. I'm here as a private citizen. I'm employed at Oregon State University as a public safety officer. I support House Bill 338 even more than I did 2 weeks ago. My experience and background are for the United States Army, Military Police Corps, the Oregon Youth Authority, Lynn Benton Juvenile Detention Center, and private security. These experiences have given me a well-rounded view of law enforcement. This legislation has never been as important as it is now. Campus public safety officers face the same unknowns, the same risks, and the same dangers as police officers. We confront career criminals, deal with drug dealers, and confiscate deadly weapons. We put our lives on the line daily. We do so willingly to protect and serve our state's campuses. We only ask for the tools and the training to do it safely and professionally. This bill can accomplish that. We have a golden opportunity to make Oregon University safer. We must be better prepared to protect our campuses. These are places of education, learning, places to play, visit, and enjoy. Please, let's take the necessary precautions to prepare for a tragedy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Committee members, I think it'd be good if we understand. I think there's different structures at different branches. Is that correct? Could you tell us which?
There's a different command. Each university has its own command structure, its own chain of command, all the way up to the director of the agency, all the way through to the president of the university. Okay. So in essence, it's like a substation.
Okay, but what I was talking about, Mr. Silver, was I think different campuses have, some have state police on board and some are all
correct. The
officers
only
like yourself.
Representative, the only two campuses that have an outside law enforcement agency is OSU, who has the Oregon State Police contracted, and University of Oregon, which has the Eugene Police Department contracted. All the other universities are left with their public safety officers.
Thank you. Okay, questions, committee?
Yes.
Hello, Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, I think you indicated that when you had called for assistance from the city of Portland, it took them fully 20 minutes to arrive to the area that you were needing assistance. Can the others of you give us some examples of the response time when you've had to call in the either contracted officers or other municipal law enforcement?
Absolutely, Chair McPherson, representatives. Anytime we call for Monmouth Assistance or Monmouth Police Department at Western Oregon University, if they know the building we are in, we're looking at a response time of 10 to 15 minutes. That's if they can gain access to the building. A lot of times in the resident halls, because they are key-coded late in the evening, night, early morning hours, they have no access. And if I happen to be on a floor, which I have on more than one occasion, and engaged with an individual that I can't break away from, they have no access other than kick the door in or wait for someone to allow them in.
Any others care to respond?
Chairman Witten-Znatt, Representative Flores. I've waited up to 20 minutes, and it's not because the city of Portland doesn't want to come help. They deal with downtown Portland with the fights, the clubs, but they also have the same problem. We cover over 49 acres of downtown Portland. If you've ever driven through Portland State University, it's not the one little row buildings on Broadway. It's a bunch of buildings spread out from there. We closed and bought a bunch of streets and then blocked them. So it's the great maze of trying to find where we are inside of our campus. I want to stress, it's not because the city doesn't want to come help us. Sometimes they don't have the resources to come help us. And other times they can't find us. They don't know where we're at.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, a concern here as public safety officers is, can you tell me what tools you do have at your hip? Do you have, obviously you don't have weapons because you're not weapon trained, according to your position. Do you have tasers? Do you have any other types of tools?
Chair, members of the committee, we do not. We are one of two classifications of people that cannot carry a firearm on campus. One is ex-felons, the other is us, by ORS. Right now, most public safety officers in the state of Oregon are equipped with an ASP baton, which is an expandable baton, and pepper spray. Several of us have submitted and requested tasers through our various different administrations, and at this point, no one's carrying them.
If I could address that, Representative Flores, we've at Portland State University for almost 4 years have been debating the issue of tasers. We haven't moved forward. It's a debate that OUS has chose to stand and not move on.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. In the verbal testimony from Mr. Collins, it says that he's a public safety officer at Oregon State University, yet we know that when Oregon State University beat Oregon in the Civil War, there's a whole bunch of state police there. Can you tell us about the structure there? So there's public safety officers and state troopers?
Yes, sir. They have both on campus, and it varies as to the numbers. We always have at least one public safety officer on campus. Depending on the night of the week, we know what's going to happen. They can have anywhere from one to five officers on campus at a given time.
So, follow up if I may. So the majority of the security is provided by the Oregon State Police?
No, sir. They do law enforcement. We do all the security. We have a nuclear reactor on campus. We're the ones that go in and do the checks. If there's an incident over there that requires an armed response, we're in the building. They come with firearms. We're stuck. I had an Oregon State Police trooper joke with me. What do you look for when you're out there? Well, we look for dead public safety officers. Then we know there's a problem in the building. That's scary.
Follow up, if I may. And maybe we heard this in the Mr. Silver's opening testimony. How many Oregon State troopers are currently on contract at Oregon State University?
10. Two of those are supervisors, one lieutenant and one sergeant.
Clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarification. Thank you. And of those 10, two are supervisors, as I understand it. And actually, this does go back to 1988 when the contract was initiated originally. One sergeant, one lieutenant, eight troopers. Now, just for clarification, that does not mean there are eight troopers available and assisting you in the work that you do on campus. It's a rotation. They don't sit there waiting to be called. There's someone is assigned to serve a limited amount of duty time on the facility. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question I want to address to Mr. Silver about the implementation, because I can't imagine that every campus security officer is going to all at once become trained and go through the training. So do you anticipate some sort of two-tiered system, or how practically speaking would this be implemented?
Chair, Representative Bonamici. I have put together a plan. I'm sure OUS has looked at this option also. Implementing is going to have to be a tiered system. If you have six officers per university campus, right now you're looking at approximately 36 officers that would have to be trained through DPSST. So there's going to have to be a time frame where these officers can get the training that is required and then move into their positions. That includes administrators are going to have to be trained. So it would have to be by a certain date that the bill would set out to have this in place, as well as Oregon State Police is going to need time to reallocate their people, same as Eugene Police Department.
Any further discussion? If not, thank you very much. Let's hear next from Jay Canton and Jack Rogers.
Chairman McPherson, members, would you like me to start? Or Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jay Ketton. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration for the Oregon University System. I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. We obviously are concerned about the safety of our students, faculty, staff, and members of the public visiting our campuses today. However, we don't feel that arming our campus safety officers is going to make our enterprise more safe in and of itself. Our objections to this bill are as follows. While we may agree that Oregon needs more police, we do not agree that Oregon needs more police departments. Creating more departments can create logistical challenges and significant issues when significant issues develop. Regardless of the level and type of staffing available on our campuses, these events will require assistance from local police departments, sheriff's offices, or the state police, and will create coordination challenges in responding to these situations. Secondly, our core business is educating students, performing leading-edge research, and providing public services. It is not operating a police department. Managing a police department is a very serious undertaking and something that demands specialized expertise. Currently, we may not possess that expertise either in our public safety departments or in our executive administrative structures. This is not to say that our public safety officers are poorly run or managed, only to say that running a police department with armed officers is a very different, much more complex activity with potentially serious implications resulting from the actions of the employees within the department. Third, the Police Academy has not had the capacity to offer full training to campus public safety officers over the last 2 to 3 years due to capacity and their impending move to a new location. However, they have agreed to begin training our officers again beginning in the fall of this year. As noted in previous testimony, this bill will add cost to our currently underfunded system of higher education. That cost is estimated at approximately $2 million this biennium, and if the Dash 1 amendments go through, it could go as high as $4 million. Furthermore, having armed officers can lead to increased risk management issues and costs. Those costs are not included in those estimates. We believe that a better way to improve the safety of our campuses is to offer a hybrid type of service that relies on campus public safety officers working in conjunction with state or local police departments. This is exactly what is offered at most of our campuses today, where through a variety of arrangements, both formal and informal, We coordinated needed public safety efforts with local police departments, sheriff's office, or with the state police. At Oregon State University, their public safety officers work side by side with state police officers. Through this hybrid model, the campus gets the best of both worlds, a trained and responsive public safety officer that can deal with the myriad situations on campuses, but with the management expertise, trained and equipped staff needed should a major event be confronted. I would now like to turn to Jack Rogers, director of OSU's Public Safety Office, to brief you on this hybrid type of arrangement that is in place at OSU today.
Mr. Rogers. Thank you. Chairman McPherson and committee, my name is Jack Rogers, and I am the director of public safety at Oregon State University. About a month ago, I was contacted by representatives from OUS to see if I would be available to come to this hearing today and speak about the unique policing arrangement that Oregon State University shares with the Department of Oregon State Police. As indicated earlier, the Oregon State Police have been contracted to provide full police services to Oregon State University since 1989. Basically, they've been on campus for the last 18 years. As the law enforcement service provider for Oregon State University, the State Police bring with them several additional tools to perform the responsibilities of having a police operation on campus. As you, most of you probably are aware of the organization of the Oregon State Police, they have several support units. I can give examples. At Oregon State University, the Oregon State Police have called upon the services of the mobile response team at times to deal. Someone mentioned earlier about the rivalry between Oregon State and Oregon. As you can imagine, the Civil War game causes the campus population to swell to well over 45 to 50,000 people. One example of having the state police operation on campus is they can call out for additional resources to bring in additional troopers to help police these games, these large events. And I'd make a note that as far as the wages for those outside troopers, the athletic department has a contract, a side contract with the Oregon State Police to literally cover the cost of overtime expenditures to bring in outside troopers to deal with the large events. State police also have at their disposal the SWAT team. There have been incidences over the past several years where, for example, we've had situations where bomb threats have come in, where the state police commander on campus was able to pick up the phone and request the response of the ordnance disposal squad for the state police. We've had the assistance and support of the state police to deal with major crimes, such as one that comes to mind is working with the Corrales Police Department a few years ago when Brooke Wilberger disappeared, and state police, and working with their local law enforcement agencies, took advantage of their resources to bring in and assist the Corvallis Police Department with investigating the disappearance of Brooke and subsequently helping to solve that case. The Oregon State campus is 7.5 square miles and consists of 575 acres. There's over 200 buildings, 200 plus buildings at Oregon State, so it's a large campus. The working relationship between the Department of Public Safety and the State Police, in my estimation, is working well. The public safety officers are responsible for the security services on campus, ranging to building security, working with the public, educational programs, those types of things. As indicated by earlier testimony from public safety officers, the State Police are responsible for investigating major crimes, responding to major crimes, and seeking to investigate those crimes. I think my experience with the Oregon State Police, I have a background with the State Police. I was with the State Police for 28 and a half years, and I've worked with the agency and have taken on the responsibility of becoming the Director of Public Safety at Oregon State University. It's a very professional outfit. They're highly trained, very responsive, and highly respected. I have had several occasions in talking with parents and relatives, representatives of students, faculty, and staff around the state, who've offered their appreciation for the knowledge that the state police do have an operation on campus. As you can well imagine, in the past 2 weeks following the Virginia Tech situation, We had numerous phone calls from concerned parents from all over the country, not just Oregon. I personally fielded several calls as far back as the state of Virginia. And one of the things that I was able to explain to the parents calling in and asking for the reassurance that their students, their sons and daughters were hopefully safe was to explain the fact that we do have a state police office on campus and that these are highly trained professionals and responsible for ensuring the safety of the students, faculty, and staff at Oregon State University. The system works very well. The university administration is highly supportive of having the state police there. It's been a good marriage between Oregon State University and the Oregon State Police, and it is a system that works really well for our unique set of circumstances at Oregon State University. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Flores, Vice Chancellor Patton, thank you very much for your information. Can you give us some insight as to why the Oregon University system is one of only two states in the country that does not allow armed security on its campuses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I'm not aware that that was a fact. I did read that in a press release that you released, but we've talked about this a couple times over the last 10 years with the Board of Higher Education, and there was a feeling, I think, from the board that it would send a message that our campuses weren't safe having armed officers on our campus or other things, or that there just wasn't a need for it. And that had been the decision. As I said in my testimony, I really like the model that Oregon State uses. I think it is an effective model that can blend the best of, having police officers on campus as well as having public safety officers. I'd also say that our students and our faculty and staff have made it pretty clear in the past that they did not support having armed officers on the campus. So it's been a conversation we've had with the campus communities, and largely it has been opposed to having an armed presence on the campus.
Additional question?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find it interesting that Mr. Rogers is telling us that he's assuring parents that they have a secure campus because they do have armed safety officers. You've just indicated that the model that Oregon State presents to us is because they do have armed safety police officers on campus, and yet we're having a discussion as to why we should not have armed public safety officers on campus. I'm puzzled. And by the way, I will quickly add that any press release that I do send out is based on fact and research.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I didn't mean to imply that it wasn't. I just am not familiar with the statistics myself. I personally support the model that Oregon State uses. We probably, would benefit by implementing it at other campuses. I don't know that creating a police department on each campus is the answer. However, I fear, as I mentioned in my testimony, that we wouldn't have, the expertise to manage that. It's really not part of our core business. And I think that utilizing, that expertise that exists in every city in which our universities are located would be a better model to approach this with.
Just a closing comment before other questions. I'm sure that the families of the students at Virginia Tech felt secure in their campus having had armed security and yet would question any other approach. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Kong.
A question for Council Chair. It's my understanding that this bill redesignates special campus security officers as public safety officers. We're not talking about whether we have state police or any other anything else on campus. This bill is about the training of the current public safety officers, much as police officers are trained.
Representative Comp, that's correct. The current phrase would be special campus security officer. under existing law. And this would say that is done away with. They're now going to be public safety officers and training them as such.
And follow up. So we are not creating a plan for safety and security on the university campuses. We are looking at a bill that is going to require additional training for the people that do currently serve as security officers on campus.
Representative Kampf, it will require additional training for those folks. I believe we have a speaker actually from Department of Public Safety Standards and Trainings who can address that.
Okay, well, yes. I just have one question for the Chancellor. My question would be, if you had this many reports about fires being set on a campus, you certainly would have firemen with training on campus. I really feel the need for training, no matter however this comes about, to give those people that are walking into the situations the safety they need for their own persons, as well as how to handle these types of volatile situations.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarification, and I know Mr. Silver is still somewhere in the room, it's my understanding that if and when this is implemented, that Oregon and Oregon State will no longer have their contractual relationships with the City of Eugene and with the Oregon State Police, because part of the justification for is cost savings, because if the campus security officers are taking the place of the police, then there won't be a cost for the contracts for the university. So I think we have to consider that as well, because we're hearing testimony that the current relationship is working at Oregon State. I think it's a bigger question than that, because obviously there's more campuses that we're talking about. But it's my understanding that it would replace that contractual relationship.
Could counsel comment on that and show us where that happens in the bill? Because that was not my understanding.
In Representative Kampf, in terms of specifically in the bill, I would need to look more closely. I don't believe that it would be specifically referenced, but I did note that it appeared that Mr. Silver was nodded in agreement with Representative Bonamici's comments that there wouldn't be the need for the part of this is there wouldn't be the need for the existing relationship, contractual relationship anymore, because we have our own.
Right.
Public safety officers.
But my understanding as a school administrator, it's not our job as a public body here as a legislator to talk about how they administer their programs. We're not directing the whole U.S. system how to maintain safety on their campuses.
Mr. Chair, just follow up. I have in my file a memorandum from Mr. Silver dated April 11th that talks about the issue of cost. It talks about the cost savings from not having a contract with the Oregon State Police and the Eugene Police Department.
Any further questions, Representative Cameron?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and yes. Chancellor, and Mr. Rogers, with being a parent of two daughters who are attending Oregon State University, I really appreciate the security that they are offered, and I think your description of that being a great model is a good example, and one of the reasons it's a great model is because of the resources that you described that are available, and in fact that we do have armed officers on the campus that are trained to be able to do that. And I, regardless of what happens out of this bill, I just would ask that that we do take a look at hearing testimony from people who are unarmed and taking a long time to get there for the security of our students. That we take a look at the higher ed's overall security system and if that is a model because of the contract, but also because I think of the resources, including arms on campus, people who are trained to use those, is what I heard. And whether it's the state police or the Eugene police or whatever police department, I think we need to really take a look at that. And it comes to a question of if the Oregon State Police weren't at OSU and some of those officers were moved over to the Albany office, for example, where we need, maybe six or eight more, would not the mobile response team still be available for the Oregon State University Athletic Department to contract with for those games and those types of things? Would they still be able to have those services?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, thank you. And also the SWAT team, because that SWAT team's coming from someplace else.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Marksman, Governor Governor Goldschmidt created this contract or provision that OSU would be staffed with Oregon State Police. Do you have any sense of the historical perspective as to whether that was intended to be a permanent arrangement?
I can't say that I would interpret that to be a permanent arrangement. I've been on the campus myself in two capacities for just under 13 years. When I first got to campus, I was the station commander with the state police, and I was told that the reason the Oregon State Police entered into a service contract with Oregon State University was because at one time there were campus police on Oregon State's campus, and that they had the commissions, or they were carrying commissioning for law enforcement purposes by the sheriff's office. I don't have the exact details, but I was told that at some point in time, the sheriff back in those times came to the realization one day that here I have folks carrying my commission cards to commission them as police officers that are not directly under my supervision, not directly under my training, and I think his liability lights started coming on as far as, okay, I've got this group of police officers located in this core campus that carry my cards, but they're not Benton County Sheriff's deputies. And so he raised a concern, and it's my understanding that he connected with the university and said, I'm giving notice now that this arrangement will be ceasing, and you're going to have to arrange to come up with your own police department. The story I was told was that someone indicated Governor Goldschmidt was the governor at the time, and basically his response was, rather than going out and creating a completely new police department and having to not only create the police department, but to provide for the supplies and services, capital outlay, patrol cars, those types of things, you will connect with the Oregon State Police and work out a service contract between the Oregon State Police and Oregon State University. And as I stated, my perception and my observations of this working relationship is that it's worked extremely well. And Representative Cameron indicated with his daughters down there, I think that even myself with my kids back when they were in college, it was a peace of mind to know that you had a highly trained professional police department available to provide the services on campus. And that's what, in fact, the Oregon State Police have managed to do and have been very successful in doing so.
Well, thank you for once again affirming the position that students and family and faculty feel more secure when there is an armed presence on campus.
Okay.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I kind of missed this piece in all the testimony we had from the Portland State officers. I think it's interesting that the University of Oregon and Oregon State have contracts, but Portland being an urban campus, you would think that they would have a contract, and for some reason they don't. Is that correct? And do you know why?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I used to be the Vice President of Finance at Portland State before I took this job, and we have informal arrangements, or Portland State has informal arrangements with Portland Police Bureau. We've looked from time to time into more formal contracts similar to what is in place at OSU, and, you know, at the time they were cost prohibitive. But, you know, I agree with Representative Cameron's suggestion that we could obviously improve the situation at all of our campuses around the system, and I would pledge to you that we'll take a look at that and do our best to, you know, ensure that we offer the best, you know, the safest campus environments we can to our clientele and to our public.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next, Eric Gablix.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Gablix. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, also known as DPSST. I'll keep my comments brief this morning. Our agency is neutral on this bill. We have had a relationship with the Oregon University System for a number of years, and you've heard about the five-week course that we have provided in partnership with the university system. The one issue we do have concern on in this bill is Section 6, which talks about reimbursement to the university system for training. Some of you in this room have actually sat on our budget committee, and you know that that issue comes up quite often, where the statute says that we will provide funds if available for training we provide, basically for the salaries and all those things. We haven't had those funds for over 12 years, if not longer. So that's a problem we have there, because the issue is, why would we add something to this statute that already creates concern every other session about where that money is going? There is a fiscal impact to this bill. What this bill would do is it would allow these officers to become police officers, which means that they would come to the 16-week basic police course and all the professional standards that go along with that. We have, as I mentioned, had a great relationship with the university system, and we look forward to working with you, and I can answer any questions you may have this morning.
Any questions for Mr. Gablix? Representative Reed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We heard some earlier testimony about future plans for officers to return to the DPSST for training. I wonder if you could give some general comments about what that training does and doesn't include.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, that's a great question. Currently, the five-week classes is truly structured around what the campus public safety officers do under their current job requirements. As you've heard, they are not police officers. They are not armed. So we do not train them to do those functions. What we do train them to do is, for example, defensive tactics that don't involve a firearm, that may involve the expandable baton that you heard about, handcuffing techniques, use of force, those kind of things that we cover, but not at the same level of a police officer because they don't have that authority. The course that we provide is truly in relationship with OUS because they need to generate the students for us to train. If there's not enough students, we don't provide that training, and we do that on a cost recovery basis with the university system. So it's not something in our current budget. It's actually something we do through an interagency agreement with OUS.
Thank you.
Representative Flores, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gablix, do you? I know that we've heard from other agencies and on other in other areas in this committee about the acts of increasing aggression, and I think that's one of the fundamental premises for this concern today. Do you have any statistics in your department about the increasing levels of aggression that we're seeing in various areas of law enforcement and public safety?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's a great question, but unfortunately we do not capture that information. We do not have a research component, so I can't give any statistical information on
that.
Thank
you.
Okay.
Questions?
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. If the university decided to give these officers the not guns, the tasers, how much training does that involve?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, that is approximately, I believe, a 2 to 3 day training class on the tasers. And then also you would look at the use of force continuum issues on that as far as when is the taser used and in what situation. So we wouldn't provide that training. We do not provide that training currently in the academy for the 16-week basic police program. And the reason is because not every agency carries the taser. But there are train-to-trainer classes where the university system could send their instructors to be trained in that and deliver that training locally.
Following up, and also the baton, or the, is that part of the training, or would
they carry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, the expandable baton is part of the five-week program that we provide now for the university system. And there again, as you heard mentioned, that we've been providing the 8-hour class, which is required for the stop and frisk. And the reason we've been doing that is because over the last few years we have had challenges getting space at the academy, but we've also had a challenge finding enough numbers to make the class cost effective. So there are instructor classes where they can train defensive tactic instructors that learn how to do that class in-house as well.
I would, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative Wisner, but I would urge the committee, we've got a long agenda yet today, and while we don't have a natural obstacle like a floor session, we do need to move forward through it.
Thank you. I think as the expert for this state in providing training to our police officers and everything, would you, how do you feel about with the current situation that just happened and the world changing like it is? Do you not advocate for more training for these?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, we're an agency that believes in professionalism and public safety regardless of what the discipline is. So we obviously always encourage more training. Whether it's a police officer, a campus public safety officer, a firefighter, we don't disagree on that. Really, the issue here with 3318 is should these people become police officers and then our relationship would change with the university system, because then we would not do probably the same training in the 5 weeks, because they would be coming to the 16-week basic police course.
If there are no further questions, thank you, Mr. Gablich.
Thank you.
One more person signed up, Mike Hansen from Western Oregon University.
First, I'd like to start out. Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Mike Hansen, for the record, and I live in Monmouth. I'm a student there and a residence assistant. I've worked there at the last Western Oregon University as a residence assistant for the last 3 years. I'm going to keep this brief and kind of cut out a lot of it to keep time going. But we, as a student there, I know we have an increasing feeling that we might need upgraded security there due to the behaviors and the situations of some of the students that are going on there. I've had incidences where we've actually had to confiscate numerous weapons and firearms and ammunition from residence halls, along with having a student run around the hall with a ski mask and what actually ended up being a toy gun. But in those cases, we've actually had to, well, with the gentleman run around the halls, we've had to wait for the local police agency, which was Monmouth PD, to respond, which took several minutes, you know, time that really, if that was a real situation, we don't have. There's instances that we've dealt with higher profile crimes of, like, cocaine possession and stuff like that, which, again, we've had to wait, and that's been reiterated over and over again. As an RA, I see a few problems with having outside agencies deal with our crimes that are being committed on our campuses, being that these public or these outside agencies don't have access to our buildings nor have the best knowledge of how to get to these buildings as quick as possible. There's numerous times where we've waited countless minutes just to have them respond, let alone having to go downstairs and let them in the buildings after hours once these buildings lock down. And just that these officers that that protect our campuses right now do not have the full training that I believe that they should need in case of a incident that goes very awry, very quick, being going into these rooms that can turn around very, very quickly. I don't see there's any reason why we shouldn't make our universities any safer, and I want to at least open up for questions and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Any questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just real quick. Thank you, Mr. Hansen, for coming and talking to us today. And as I said earlier, two daughters who are both RAs at Oregon State University, and many times have said, Dad, I've had to call the police and they're there within 5 minutes or so. State police are there. Can you tell us, have you ever had, when you have to call the police, how long before armed police show up?
I've had incidents waiting for probably about 15 minutes. Not only just armed police, medical emergencies and stuff like that, being that our public safety agency isn't dispatched by 911. I think they have to overhear it on their radios and whatnot to respond to the first agency. If it's called on campus, they can hear it over the radios and whatnot and dispatch. But I also see that if, you know, 911 dispatches them as a first responder, it's much quicker, you know, not waiting the 15, 20 minutes that a first responder could or have to take to get there.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Flores, we just very briefly, we've got many
Thank
items
you, Mr. Hansen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apparently, this morning there was a report of an arsonist running around setting fires on Pacific University campus. Could you give us your perspective as an RA, and there was no one on campus to be able to stop this guy from running around setting fires?
Well, as an RA, it's that's just a scary incident that, I mean, I can only just hope it doesn't happen, because we would have to just basically kind of sit back and try to evacuate those buildings, and I see this as just taking time that we don't have to get a person like that under control and detained, that, you know, who knows if they're armed or whatnot, and we're waiting for other outside agencies.
Yeah, thank you. If we lived in a perfect world, those things wouldn't happen, but the reality is they do. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. That's our last witness, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3318. Next, we're going to go next committee to House Bill 3515. Representative Flores.
Were we not going to have the opportunity to move this to a work session?
We will not be taking a work session now, because we've got some other bills we were waiting for work session on, so I'm going to go to those first.
We'll be carrying over.
All right. May well be carried over.
I think this is something the public's looking for leadership from this body. I just think we need to assure the public out there that have kids that we need to do something about.
I understand. We've got a lot of people who gathered here today on other items that we have before us, and we've got a limited amount of time, so we need to move on through our agenda.
Well, I would affirm with Representative Wisnett that this is a public safety issue, and I think we need to be moving forward. So I hope that you will be bringing it back forward for contemplation of a work session.
Thank you, Representative. Now open a work session on House Bill 3515. It's my intention, committee, so you get a little roadmap to do that one first, because it is connected to House Bill 2843. So I'm taking them out of order the way they're printed, so that we go to because it's a less extensive impact kind of proposal, and then we will move on to take the input on 2843. So we're in work session on 3515. Councilor Stanford.
The committee. House Bill 3515 was previously heard by the committee on April 6th. This again goes back to the public hearing on preventing internet predators that we had at Aloha High School. House Bill 3515 creates two new crimes: the online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree and online sexual corruption of a child in the first degree. What I'm going to be talking about for the summary is the -4 amendments. Those are the ones that are significant. Online sexual corruption of a child, and child is defined as someone under the age of 16, in the second degree involves the following elements. First, defendant is 18 or older. Second, for the purpose of arousing the sexual desires of the defendant or another person. Third element, knowingly uses an online communication to solicit a child to engage in sexual contact or sexually explicit conduct. Sexual contact and sexually explicit conduct have the same definitions as existing Oregon law. There is no defense if the child is actually a law enforcement officer or someone working at the direction of a law enforcement officer posing as a decoy. Online sexual corruption of a child in the first degree, which is a Class B felony, second degree is a Class C felony. Online sexual corruption of a child in the first degree involves, first, the second degree crime, plus the person takes a substantial step towards physically meeting with or encountering the child. Again, there is no defense if the child is actually a law enforcement officer or someone working at the direction of a law enforcement officer. Both first and second degree online sexual corruption are registrable sex offenses.
Thank you, counsel. Committee, we have the -4 amendments in front of us. And counsel, remind me, the committee, what were the issues that evolved to the -4s?
Chair McPherson, there were a number of issues. In the original bill, originally online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree included language, and you can see it in the original bill if you look, that on page 1, lines 11 and 12, that you would commit online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree if you solicit a child to engage in sexual contact or sexually explicit conduct, that's still in, or if you subject a child to an explicit verbal description or narrative account of sexual contact or sexually explicit conduct.
that part was eliminated. The idea being that is nothing, that we could be potentially punishing mere words alone, constitutional concerns. That is out. What was left in, though, is if you're soliciting, meaning that you're taking, you're trying to do something, take an action that's clearly a criminal action. So that, I would say that's the most significant change from the original bill to the dash four. In addition, there were some age clarifications. The original bill said the defendant had to be over 21. In the present version, defendant's 18 or older. In an amended, one amended version, the victim could be 17 or younger, but now it's under age 15. So there's sort of a natural three-year discrepancy that's built into 3515, and there's also a specific affirmative defense if you have a defendant, if you have a victim, for example, who's just about to turn 16, but is age 15 in 350 days, and the defendant just turned 18, there's a three-year age difference affirmative defense that's in the bill. So those are the main, those are the primary issues that were addressed in the dash four.
Committee, what we're trying to accomplish with this bill is to get at predatory conduct by older offenders and not sweep in the kind of things that are done by same age kind of people who aren't exercising particularly good judgment, as I think probably many of us didn't, if we recall being at that stage in life. No further comment on that point. So we have the dash four amendments before us. Do I hear a motion? Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash fours into House Bill 3515.
Representative Kahn moves the dash four amendments into House Bill 3515. Any discussion?
Go ahead.
I just have a question. I'm sorry, I have to leave room for a minute. Are the dash four amendments a consensus?
Representative Bonamici, I'll say yes with a caveat. The caveat is there's one issue that is not a large issue that I've spoken with Ms. Christian and criminal defense lawyers about. That basically it's this: whether that the online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree, which I went through the elements where it says you the elements of second degree are you knowingly use an online communication to solicit a child to engage in sexual contact or sexually explicit conduct, whether the line and you offer or attempt to meet with the person, whether that part should be included. That's the only discrepancy there, and if that is a consensus, that can be added subsequently. The position is solicit implies that enough. And so, and the main thing is, the main concern that folks had at these meetings was what is in the original bill, lines 11 and 12, that subjecting a child to an explicit verbal description or narrative account, that gets too much at punishing just words, and that was eliminated.
Thank you.
And that was my question. Why was line 11 eliminated?
Representative Cameron, the idea being that I'm speaking for what happened at the sort of work groups on this, and my understanding generally is that as phrased, if you are literally just, it potentially would have constitutional concerns. And the constitutional concerns are that you are doing nothing more than words, and that there's no sexual intent or anything that the person who's sending these words has. I know that's a somewhat vague thing. I'm being a little bit vague there. But the idea is what you wanted to capture constitutionally, what you can capture constitutionally without question, is the solicitation. If I'm trying to get them to do something, perhaps I'm doing the same thing. I'm talking to them about sex and engaging in dirty talk, but I'm taking it a little step further by trying to seduce or solicit. B is just subjecting them to a verbal description of such. There were constitutional concerns. Compromise, it was taken out, if that's helpful.
It's helpful. I'm going to support the bill, but it seems like it got watered down a little bit from, verbal descriptions and narrative account of sexual contact. If somebody is doing that to a 13 or 12 year old, I think that's a problem that's going to lead to other things. So, if this is what we have to live with, I'll accept it. But I don't know what was wrong with the original bill. So,
could you talk about line 13 solicit in the dash 4 as compared to solicit in line 10? 14 has a much greater 13, 14.
In the dash 4?
Yeah.
I'm looking at solicit and the dash 4 amendments. The term solicit means, and it's a broad definition of solicit.
Yeah.
Invite, request, seduce, lure, entice, persuade, prevail upon, coax, coerce, or attempt to do so. As far as I see, that's the same in the original bill. On line 28,
okay,
for the definition of solicit, and that is taken in large part. There are, I believe, other provisions in Oregon law that define solicit, or other bills that are being considered this session. I'm looking at Mr. Nasby from Legislative Council right now.
Counsel, I have a question about the attempt to solicit. I know there's some distinction between a solicitation and an attempt, but is an attempt to solicit a double attempt? I know that that's a concern that was raised about the original. Is it an attempt to solicit an attempt to attempt to do something? Is it like a double?
Representative Bonamici, a very fair question that was talked about. Mr. Nasby, I think, would be best addressed from Legislative Council to talk about that.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Nasby. I'm a deputy with Legislative Council's office. Two quick questions, or answers rather. The first, in response to Representative Krieger's question, invite and request were added to the definition of solicit. And the goal there was just to broaden the definition to pick up. I wasn't satisfied that the definition as it existed picked up just in a request. Yeah. And so that was the purpose for that. In response to Representative Bonamici's concern, the attempt to do so in the definition of solicit modifies all of those verbs in the sense that the solicitor need not be successful in actually soliciting the sexual act. And so it's not an attempt crime. It's just intended to indicate that the solicitation need not be successful.
Thank you. So for clarification, Mr. Chair, the attempt to seduce, the attempt to lure, the attempt to entice, persuade, prevail, the attempt to invite, the attempt to request. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a motion before us to move to amend House Bill 3515 with the dash 4 amendments. Any further discussion?
Chair, I'll move House Bill 35.
Actually, we have to act on the amendments. So just pause here for a moment. If there's no further discussion on the dash 4 amendments, is there any objection to the dash 4 amendments? If not, then the dash 4 amendments are adopted. Representative Cameron.
Oh, we had a motion already to adopt.
We had a motion to adopt the dash 4 amendments from Representative Kahn.
We're getting tired.
Follow-up, Chair. I move House Bill 3515 as amended with the dash 4s with the due pass to the floor.
Or
is there a subsequent?
Designed this so that it was to not have a fiscal impact because of it not elevating the penalty beyond an attempt crime. So if I could understand that move with a due pass and request for rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
I'll restate the whole thing.
Okay.
I move House Bill 3515 as amended with the dash 4 amendments and rescind the previous...
Request rescission of the prior referral to Ways and Means.
Request rescission of the prior referral to Ways and Means with a due pass
recommendation.
Recommendation.
You heard the motion, committee. Is there any discussion? Representative Bonamici?
I still want to ponder. I'll give this a courtesy vote. I still want to ponder the what I perceive as a bit of a double attempt issue and the difference between solicitation and attempt. So I just want to put that on the record. I'm still working that through.
Okay.
And I know that was a concern that was raised by the criminal defense attorney. So I just want to ponder that a bit.
Very good.
Moving along.
Any further discussion? If not, then we have a motion before us to move House Bill 3515 with, as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to from the committee to pass with the requested rescission of the referral to Ways and Means. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Ford.
Aye.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Friedman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker excused. Vice Chair Wisnik.
Aye.
Chairman Ferguson.
Aye.
House Bill 3515 has moved to pass from the committee. Close the work session 3515. Now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2843. Well, I'll carry it. If we do succeed in getting the rescission, then the chair will carry the bill.
House Bill 2843 was before the committee previously on April the 6th. It relates to the related issue of pornography and also luring a minor. What we should be considering, we're focusing primarily on two different amendments, and I apologize, in the staff measure summary it says dash 1 and dash 2. It should say dash 3 is one set that we'll be considering, and then there's also then a dash 4 amendment, and I'll explain both. House Bill 2843 arises out of a bipartisan coalition from the House and Senate to address problems related to pornography in children and the luring of minors for sexual conduct and activity. Its primary purpose lies in the creation of two new crimes: furnishing sexually explicit material to a child, a Class A misdemeanor, and luring a minor, a Class C felony. Furnishing sexually explicit material to a child, and the statute is clear that a child, we're talking about someone under the age of 13, consists of the following elements. Defendant intentionally furnishes a child or intentionally permits a child to view sexually explicit material that the defendant knows is sexually explicit material. Sexually explicit material is defined, and it has material that has visual images of masturbation or sexual intercourse, genital to genital, oral to genital, anal to genital, or oral to oral contact, or the penetration of the vagina or rectum by any object. There are specific affirmative defenses. There is a specific exception for museum, school, or library employees acting in the scope of employment. There are also then certain affirmative defenses, including if the materials are for sexual education, art education, they're for treatment, or they're furnished by a parent, guardian, educator, or treatment provider. Also, if the sexually explicit material is merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole and serves some purpose other than titillation. If the defendant had a reasonable cause to believe that the victim was not a child, or if the defendant was less than 3 years older than the victim. These are all affirmative defenses. It is not an affirmative defense if the victim is actually a law enforcement officer posing as a child. This is Section 2 of the Bill 2843. Section 3 of 2843 is the crime of luring a minor. And again, it's an important age distinction. Whereas the first one was child under age 12, minor now we're talking under age 18. Luring a minor consists of the following elements. 1. Defendant furnishes to or uses with a minor. 2. Visual representation or verbal description or narrative account. 3. Of sexual conduct. And 4. The purpose was to arouse or satisfy the sexual desires of the defendant or to induce the minor to engage in sexual conduct. The affirmative defenses for luring are similar to those for furnishing. The definition of sexual conduct is the same as for sexually explicit material, except that conduct also includes the touching of the genitals, pubic areas, buttocks, or female breasts. House Bill 2843, let's talk about the Dash 3. The Dash 3 amendments, most significant change of the Dash 3 amendments is that they eliminate certain changes to Section 10 in the original bill. We can talk more specifically about those changes. We have folks here that can answer some questions about that. The Dash 4 amendment is different. The Dash 4 amendment deletes all of Section 2. So there would be no furnishing sexually explicit material to a child. That is eliminated altogether. And there's one other change then that it makes to Section 3, the Dash 4 amendments do. It eliminates a certain element about arousal and says that you would, rather than the purpose being to arouse or satisfy the sexual desires of the defendant, that's eliminated, and you must be inducing the minor to engage in sexual conduct. That's the Dash 4 amendment for 2843.
Thank you, counsel. Committee, we opened these two bills in this order because this is a broader bill that is, has wider impacts than House Bill 3515, which we just moved out, although I think relates to the same subject matter because of the evidence we heard before that furnishing pornography, particularly over the Internet, is a grooming behavior. But because of its greater breadth, it raised some issues that the prior bill did not. I would like to have Representative Olson come and give his perspective on the bill and anyone else that he would like to have come up with him. And Representative Olson, I appreciate your hard work on this effort, this bill. You've been stalwart in this effort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Andy Olson. I'm the state representative from the Albany area. And this committee has already heard the nuts and bolts of this bill. And Mr. Stanford did a good job of describing the Dash 3s as well as the Dash 4s, but also, again, the nuts and bolts of the bill. What our main purpose is here today to come back to you is because there was an issue of some constitutionality that surfaced the last time that you heard this bill. There's been a lot of homework done, a lot of discussion since that time, and that's why the folks that are here with me today are here as well to kind of address those issues. But I think as I was sharing with you the other day, Chair, that I think I'm borderline maybe trying for the test for the bar. I don't know, learning all this stuff.
Well, if you were a member, you'd definitely get continuing education credit.
Anyways, I think with that, I'm in support of the Dash 3s. I do want you to know that the description in the Dash 4s is somewhat, it is, it's a different direction from what we had discussed when members from ACLU had been on board with us through the entire work group session during the interim in support of Section 2, and now it's a different direction from that agreement or that discussion that we had during the interim. So with that, I would actually like to have, Mara, I'll let you just kind of share.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Mara Gross. I am the legislative assistant to Senator Kate Brown, who, in her words, represents a little bit of Northeast Portland, a lot of bit of Southeast Portland, and the city of Milwaukee. Would like on her behalf, I guess, since she was unable to be here personally, to echo Representative Olson's support for the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2843. There were many discussions around this, and Senator Brown is comfortable with the Dash 3s as they relate to the constitutionality, and she believes it's important. The Section 2, the section on furnishing, which are omitted in the Dash 4 amendments, she believes that they are important to stop predators before children are physically harmed. Thank you.
The committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice in the Organized Crime Section. I'm also assigned to the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. I was not a member of the original work group on this. My previous supervisor was, but I know there's a lot of work done on this particular bill, especially, and I'll just talk about constitutional issues related to Section 2. What I understand the goal of the work committee was is to try to narrowly define this language so that we comply with Oregon constitutional standards. And the goal with that is to use the guidance that we've been given by the court so that we could withstand a constitutional challenge. What we can't do is predict what the court ultimately is going to do with the statute. Our goal, again, is just simply to try to comply with the guidelines the court has already given us, and that's what the work group did here. There's nothing more you can do with the particular language in Section 2 to make it any tighter to withstand constitutional scrutiny. What we can do now is leave it up to the courts to decide whether or not it's in fact constitutional. I'm talking specifically about Article 1, Section 8 under the Oregon Constitution. there was some question about it at the last hearing about whether or not, okay, so you do satisfy, we can all kind of agree that it does comply with the guidance the court has given us on Article 1, Section 8, but let's talk a little bit about the First Amendment and are we actually compliant with the First Amendment. And Oregon courts have made it clear, and I'm talking about State versus Henry, the Article 1, Section 8 is a much broader protection for free expression than under the First Amendment. Nevertheless, there was still some question about whether or not we should import some language from the federal courts dealing with what is obscene. And what was asked to sort of be put into 2843 deals with what's obscene as from adult to adult, not with children. And both on the federal level and on the state level, the courts have made it clear that kids are different and that what you can give to an adult, you can't necessarily give to a child. So on a fundamental level, if we were trying to put the obscenity, what was the obscenity test under federal law in the 2843, we'd be making, the first mistake we'd be making is thinking that adults are the same as children, and they're not. But probably more fundamental with trying to, more fundamental problem with trying to put the obscenity test from federal law into our Oregon law is that it completely is incompatible with what our Supreme Court has said. And let me talk to you a little bit about what we have, what has been proposed that we would put in there to sort of codify, if you will, the federal obscenity statute. You would say that the material, you'd have a further description of the material that would be provided to the child. And you'd add these further factors, that it predominantly appeals to the prurient, shameful, or morbid interests of minors in sex, that's patently offensive to the average adult in the statewide community as a whole when applying contemporary community standards with respect to what is suitable for material for minors, and that it lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. And that was a three-part test that was proposed to be added into 2843 to quote-unquote, make it comply with the First Amendment. I can tell you that that language just does not work in Oregon. And I'll start first with the idea that we could put in here some language dealing with a statewide community standard as a way of describing what is obscene for kids and what's not obscene. So what you would do is if you have a particular photograph or some image here, what would make this obscene or not obscene would depend on the community standards is what was proposed to add in here. And I will say, this is what our Supreme Court said about relying on community standards. Even in ordinary criminal law, we doubt that the legislature can make it a crime to conduct oneself in a manner that falls short of, quote, contemporary state standards, end quote. In a law centering speech, writing, or publication, such an interminable test is intolerable. It means that anyone who publishes or distributes arguably, quote, obscene, end quote, words or pictures does so at the peril of punishment for making a wrong guess about what a future jury's estimate of, quote, contemporary state standards, end quote, of prurience. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. So what the court is telling us is you have to use very descriptive terms. The other terms that we were asked important to this particular bill are words like shameful or morbid. So what would make something criminal or uncriminal would depend on somebody's assessment about what is morbid or shameful. Those are the types of words and terms that are too vague, would not survive our court's scrutiny.
Mr. Slauson, I'm sorry. Could you give us the cite to that Supreme Court opinion?
I don't have that specific cite in front of me. Do you have it? It's State versus Henry. And what it was is State versus Henry tried to codify the federal constitutional standard for obscenity. And the Supreme Court found that statute to be unconstitutional, because it would not recognize that this state could use those types of terms that are so broad. So just getting back quickly to what 2843 does and the reason why it would be inadvisable to try to import the federal language. One, the federal language applies to obscenity from adults to adults, not this material to children. And it uses terms that our Supreme Court has expressly said we cannot use. What we have done instead is to get away from terms like shameful and morbid and words that are pretty ambiguous and gotten to very specific language. So everybody knows specifically what's prohibitive and what they cannot give to a child under 13, intentionally give, I should say, to a child under 13.
Any further questions for anybody on this panel?
I have a question.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know in our previous public hearing on this, there was a concern raised about juvenile offenders, and you're talking about adult to children and how that's treated differently from adult to adult. But what about a 19-year-old? And was that difference addressed in the amendment?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Bonamici, a 19-year-old is considered an adult. From age 18 upward is an adult.
Okay, so, I guess I should have used 17-year-old. Okay. Is this going to apply to juvenile offenders?
Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, it would apply to a juvenile offender, as I can see here, unless I've missed something, but I would like to point out, though, that the focus is on the harm to the children who are viewing the material. So it's to be somebody under 13, and that's the change. It's when we talk about adult to child, it's because of the harm to the child and what we want to prevent the child from viewing. Different from adult, adults can see, or there's less restriction the state can impose on what the adults can view versus children.
I just wanted to make that clear, that that was a concern raised by the Juvenile Rights Project about the differences between teen and adult offenders.
Representative Crump.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, if you help me out for a moment, I'm a little lost. And is Mr. Slauson, are you in support of the bill? And if you are, which amendment or as printed?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, I came up here to testify to address some of the constitutional issues that were raised.
I understood that.
And I am in support of the -3 amendments.
Thank you.
At 11 o'clock, we're going to adjourn our meeting because we've got a caucus meeting at that point, and we will have been in meeting continuously for 4 hours, which is quite a long stretch, and I appreciate the energy you've brought to this. I would like to conclude our work on this bill before 11, and to do that, I'd like to hear from some other folks as well who have perspectives on this. So I'd like to excuse this panel, and then we get down to decision point. Ms.
Can I just ask a possible question?
Go ahead.
The -3 amendments make no changes to Section 2. Is that correct? I'm just trying to figure this out.
That's correct. That's
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
Right.
And in the opinion of the Department of Justice, passed constitutional muster.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And Mr. Hughes, do you want to come up as well?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Marr from the ACLU of Oregon. As you recall, David Fedanke testified previously on this bill. Let me explain briefly. The ACLU was a neutral as the work group. And the reason we were neutral was we had significant concerns about Section 2, but we did become neutral then. And we do apologize, and I will reiterate it again. We failed to vet this under the First Amendment analysis.
Right.
That's when the MPAA came in. We did with ours. That's where our problem with Section 2 arose. We still do believe it is at risk for a constitutional violation under the First Amendment. As such, we worked with talked to our national about whether we thought there was language that could fix it. We could not find language that fixed it. As Mr. Slauson has described, others came up with some language importing the federal language. He went over that with you, the standard. And under State v. Henry, they believe that would violate now Article 1, Section 8. So from where ACLU stands, we have introduced or had drafted the -4s. What they do is they do remove Section 2. We strongly believe that it's constitutionally vulnerable. We make a fix in Section 3 that both the MPAA and our national ACLU thought raised First Amendment concerns, but without disrupting the intent. The ACLU came to the table on this, and we were at the table 6 years ago with John Minnis and others about the issue of getting to what is referred to now as the luring, Section 3, what I've always referred to as grooming. Those people who are going after someone with the intent of engaging in criminal activity and don't quite get there far enough, and they use material. Section 2, we were very concerned because it doesn't have that mens rea, that intent to commit a crime. So Section 3, we believe, is preserved. It's time, we believe, and with our amendments, we would actually be in support of this bill. It is time, we believe, that we pass a law in this area that I think almost everyone can agree, in its narrow form, is constitutionally sound. Good folks may disagree about Section 2, but it is vulnerable to an attack. And it is time to get these, this law, as you know, and I compliment Senator Brown and Representative Olson for working on this. It is a law that's difficult and complicated, but it is time to get it fixed in a way that goes after the gap in the law that we have not been able to fix. I would urge you to adopt the Dash 4s. I know it doesn't go as far as some want, but I think that no one has argued, we've argued over and over again, I haven't heard a lot saying that Section 2 is not significantly vulnerable to an attack, and we just believe as a policy it goes too far.
Representative Flores, we've got to conclude our action by 11, so the more
questions
we ask, the more difficult.
Unless you're going to carry this over. Ms. Meyer, you just heard the Department of Justice put on the record that they support the Dash 3 amendments, that Section 2 in the bill, as addressed, does pass constitutional muster. So I have a little difficulty with your
Chair McPherson, assertion. Representative Flores, with all due respect, the Department of Justice has defended these statutes year over year, and we have case law where these statutes have not been upheld. And while I profoundly respect the legal analysis of the Department of Justice, I also profoundly respect First Amendment analysis from the ACLU nationally that deals with these issues on a First Amendment-specific area rather than an Oregon-specific area. That's why I said good minds may disagree, but what I'm assured of, because there's a disagreement, is it will be challenged. It will be challenged, and we would like to go forward with legislation that won't be. And we think Section 3, currently with that additional language, is also vulnerable, and that would be the last thing we want, is Section 3, the grooming provision, to be subject to an attack. And you leave it up to the courts, and I agree, we may lose or we may win. But we believe that this is such an important issue that we need to move forward in a way that is not constitutionally infirm.
Let's hear from Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes, representing the Motion Picture Association of America. That's the association that represents Disney, Fox, Paramount, Sony, Universal, and Warner. The memo that I passed out to you was for the bill in its original form. We did not know that there was a Dash 3 or a Dash 4 amendments out there until this morning. So I had them, it was our word that the sponsors were going to go with the original bill, so I had them, again, look at the Attorney General's two cases that they cited. And it's a case of who has more lawyers and who has better law firms, the Attorney General or the combined studios. It's a disagreement, and our people have totally disagreed with the interpretation of the Attorney General's office. And you can see that on the first paragraph on the second page of this tiny memo I put out. But let me say this, that, we all want to protect children from harmful materials. And I guess it's a big disagreement on how do you do it constitutionally. And the Motion Picture Association of America would like it to be constitutional, so that they're in the business, by the way, of challenging unconstitutional laws around the country, in cities, in counties, and hamlets all throughout the country. And they don't want to do that. They want a law that would put people away when they're doing what they shouldn't be doing. And I will ask you to read the second paragraph on the first page and the first paragraph on the second page, and I won't say anything more because of your time. appreciate your time and concern. We did have, by the way, I want to thank the sponsors of this bill, Representative Olson and Senator Brown. We put a work group together on the recommendation of the committee here, and your committee administrator, Darren, was very, very helpful. My people flew out and spent a day in Oregon, participated in the work group, and we all came to an agreement and about constitutionality. My people flew back thinking it was all done until 2 days ago when Representative Olson told me that it was going to be go back to the original bill. We were surprised, and that's when I asked them for this memo. So thank you for the work group and the time we've spent on this.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
Chairman Pearson, may I just impose one thing? With all due respect, I was part of that work group. ACLU never agreed to that language. We had concerns. That's the federal language. DOJ and ACLU agreed that it would violate Article 1, Section 8. We actually do agree with DOJ on one. And so with all due respect, I just wanted to clarify for the record that we made it really clear at that meeting we were not on board.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Meyer.
If we have limited time, obviously. I would, if it's useful for the committee, in terms of what they're I could describe in a couple of minutes, a minute and a half, 30 seconds, what their motion picture folks' concerns were, what was agreed to, and then why that switched.
Is that helpful to get that back to the committee?
Yes.
I think it would be very helpful.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's go ahead.
Okay.
With the indulgence of the fellow members with whom I'm doing a meeting
unless
at 11,
Mr. Chair,
we'll carry over just a little minutes.
You're not intending to move this today, if you want to.
We've got so many items rolling over. I think we should, it's fresh before us. I think we ought to decide where we're going to go and do it.
Okay.
If I say something incorrectly, I'm sure I'll get something thrown at me. But in a nutshell, here's what it was. Some of you, the motion picture folks came out and we met. And they talked about their concerns and they presented. Here's what I would say their main changes were to the bill. And I'm talking about Section 2. Like, all this focus is about Section 2. They wanted to change the, right now in Section 2, the language that's used is sexually explicit material. They proposed a changing that language to say material that is harmful to minors. That's one change. It's somewhat of a semantic change, focusing more on the effects of the material versus the material itself. That was one change that they had, the more substantive one I'm about to deal with. They then specifically defined the term, what is harmful to minors, as follows. And this is the crux of what their concerns were. They wanted to say, material that's harmful to minors, it is harmful to minors if it's material that depicts or describes actual or simulated sexual contact, when taken as a whole, it does three things. And these three things come from a United States Supreme Court case. The case is Ginsburg, I believe, in 1969. It's very similar to other federal language, named Miller, etc. Here are the three elements that they wanted included in this bill. One, that this material has to predominantly appear to the prurient, shameful or morbid interest of minors in sex. That's element one. Element two, that it is patently offensive to the average adult in the statewide community as a whole when applying contemporary community standards with respect to what is suitable material for minors. That's the second element. The third element, and it's and, so we're talking all three, and the material lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. That was the crux of their change. Put this in and we're going to be fine. At the meeting we talked and thought, sure, this can work. And part of the reason is because this was based on interpretation of federal case law, where standard United States Supreme Court case law, no less, where standards like this had been upheld. At the meeting, Mr. Slauson, who I'll represent as being one of, if not DOJ's most knowledgeable person about Article 1, Section 8, was not there. And so we decided this works, it's fine, let's move with it like this. Subsequently, there was a more clear review of Oregon case law that called into question this Oregon's ability to do this. And I'll start at the outset by saying in, I think, 46 out of the 50 states in the union, this standard would be great and would work fine and perhaps and does work fine. Oregon is different. Oregon has interpreted Article 1, Section 8 to be much broader in many ways than the First Amendment, and they make that clear in case after case that Oregon
Oregon's free speech law. The case is State versus Henry. That is the main one, I think, that calls into question this standard. And Mr. Slauson already summarized that for you. State versus Henry specifically looked at the issue, specifically looked at this patently offensive to the average adult in the statewide community applying contemporary community standards. They looked at that and they said, that is what the feds do. That is what is recommended by a group called the National Conference on State Legislatures that other states adopt. In Oregon, we say no. We are not going to do that. It is, people shouldn't have to guess. It's a moving target. It is, it was both vague. They ruled it as both vague and then under Article 1, Section 8. Now, I had a conversation with the motion picture folks explaining this to them. Like, look, we saw this case. Their response was the Henry case dealt with adult world, adults distributing materials to adults. It doesn't talk about adults distributing materials to minors, or, again, in 2843, we're talking about children under 12, an even smaller group. As counsel, I believe I can weigh in on this. They're correct. It does not. But the language that is used in the case of State versus Henry and the concerns that are raised by applying this contemporary standard, looking at what the average adult would think, those concerns that are raised in State versus Henry are not concerns that would just be limited to the adult world. The same concerns, the same reasons that they struck it in adult world, I think it would likely be stricken in minor world too. That it's a moving target, that you don't know exactly what it is. You need specificity. Oregon rejects that kind of a case. I don't care if it's adult or children. And I believe that was the opinion that Mr. Slauson shared. And so for that reason, that standard that was suggested is unworkable. It was the opinion of the group that it, or some in the group, that that is unworkable in Oregon. Now, that's just one of the elements. I haven't talked about A or C, or A or C. I haven't talked about the first or the third. The predominantly appeals to the prurient interest of minors in sex, or lack serious artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. Those concerns, I believe, are addressed in the bill in existing affirmative defenses in language. Look at Section 2 and 3A and 3B. And what we're talking about there, got the wrong bill here. There is specific language in the bill that says, right now, sexually explicit material, it is a defense in this case, if the sexually explicit material is an incidental part of a non-offending whole and serves some purpose other than titillation. That very much seems to mirror or track the Motion Picture Association's prong of lack serious literary, artistic, or scientific value. It's just Oregon's way, or it's a different way of saying the same thing. That is built into the bill in existing language. And in fact, I'm sorry.
Page, line.
I'm looking at the original bill, page 2. It would be line
14 and 15.
Thank you. Yeah, 13, 14, and 15.
Thank you.
That's built into the bill already. And then also 3A, that the sexually explicit material was furnished or viewing was permitted solely for the purpose of sex education, art education, treatment, etc. The combination of 3A, 3B gets at those same prurient interest in sex, lacks serious literary, artistic, scientific value concerns that the motion picture people had. And one other thing I'll say about it, I know it hasn't been entirely clear, but the language that is used in this bill about the sexually explicit material being an incidental part of a non-offending whole and serving some purpose other than titillation isn't entirely made-up language. That language came and was essentially affirmed in a different Oregon case, State versus Maynard, which is a 2000 Court of Appeals case, looked at that language and said it's okay. So, in short, there was a three-prong test that the Motion Picture Association thought should be adopted into existing law. Prong two, it is the opinion of various people, we cannot do that, based on what Oregon Supreme Court has said. Prongs one and three, those concerns, the idea is, those are already addressed within the existing language of the bill.
Thank you.
that's a summary of how things went. It was a very productive meeting. It was an excellent meeting with the people that came out, and that's everything. If anybody has any other questions for me, I hope that was a little longer than 30 seconds.
I have a question. So based on, I haven't read the Henry case, but based on the adult to adult and this is adult to children case, do you believe that this language in Section 2 of the bill would be, that it's distinguishable enough because of it's an it, because it's an adult to child rather than an adult to adult situation, that it may be upheld?
As counsel, I do. And, yes. And I base that, I believe I gave Representative Flores my copy of Henry.
Oh, it's back
here.
Back.
There is language in Henry, and I believe also in a couple of other key cases, Stoneman and then the Maynard case, but I think I'm talking about Henry specifically. Mr. Slauson, correct me if I'm wrong, that says, Henry reversed the conviction of an adult defendant for disseminating obscene material to adults. It said, nope, can't do that under Article 1, Section 8. But it said specifically on a number of different occasions, I'll quote, "We do not hold that this form of expression, like others, may not be regulated in the interest of unwilling viewers, captive audiences, minors, and beleaguered, neighbors. So in holding its what it held, Henry left open the door that adult to adult can't go there. Adult to minors, maybe. And so if that answers the question.
Committee, I think it's there's probably only a limited amount of penetration we can accomplish and further in this this issue here.
I don't care for your use of terms,
okay,
sir.
Well, I'm sorry. Understanding of our ability to grasp this situation is limited here. And limited by the clock, if nothing else. Sorry about that. That was not intended.
No, I know.
It's been a long day, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it sure has.
Can I ask one more question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
I'm sorry, Representative Krieger, but we're talking about First Amendment rights, which I hold near and dear. Have you also analyzed the language in Section 2 under the U.S. Constitution as well as under Article 1, Section 8?
Personally, I think others have done it more closely than me, including Mr. Slauson. I have not to the same extent that I have Article 1, Section 8. And my take on it, again, you never know, of course, what could ultimately happen, but that if it survives Article 1, Section 8, it's going to survive the First Amendment. And I know that there some, Ms. Meyer would disagree with that. I'll note that on the record, but
she
don't.
She does disagree. Right.
Yes, she does disagree with that.
So, committee, the issue before us, I see some dash one amendments in here, but they're out of questions. Really, the issue is, do we move this House Bill 2843 with the dash threes or the dash fours? The dash fours eliminate the constitutionality issues by just taking the whole furnishing out of the bill. The dash threes are our best shot at a constitutional bill.
The dash four is
the dash four.
The dash threes are our best shot, given that we're going to have a furnishing element.
It's
been crafted to be as effective or as likely to be constitutional as it can be, if we're going to have a furnishing element in. That's what I meant to say.
Mr. Chair, are we in a work session?
We are in work session.
I'll move the dash three amendments into House Bill 2843.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 2843. Any discussion of that motion?
My only point is, in light of the discussion that we've had about the First Amendment, that it's likely to be challenged. And, of course, there's no guarantee what the outcome will be. But it'll be challenged. There are questions have been raised.
Mr. Chair, I've heard many times in this building in regard to legislation that this body has passed. Bring it on.
Is there an objection to the adoption of the dash three amendments? Not hearing any of the dash three amendments are in the bill.
Chair, I would move House Bill 2843 with the dash threes. Is there a referral?
There is a subsequent to Ways and Means.
The subsequent referral to Ways and Means and do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2843 as amended by the dash three amendments to with the do pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
And what's,
Chair?
What's the referral? Why is that on there?
Because it adds new criminal penalties for this conduct.
So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, so the last bill we just we asked to rescind the Ways and Means, it added new criminal.
Actually, it didn't, because it took the crime of attempt and it simply extended it to that conduct, which is we're specifically describing it. So it was designed, in fact, to not trigger the fiscal impact, whereas this bill here is clearly a new elevated set of penalties for this conduct.
Okay.
Is there any further discussion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Could I ask for reverse order?
No, I'm going to vote aye, but I'm very hesitant about it, and I'd feel better about sending something on that really addresses the luring part and that we knew would be upheld. But I know this is an issue that a lot of people are concerned about, so I'll give it an aye to get it going.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Aye.
House Bill 2843 moves from our committee due pass to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2843. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can get done. I'm going to recite again for the record. The following bills are rolled over until our next meeting at 8 a.m. on Monday, the 30th of April. House Bill 2740, 2890, 2144, 2152, 2179, 2766, 3129, 3279, 3251, and 3369. Thank you for your long attention to our agenda today, members. We did not notice the meeting early enough to be able to get 48 hours notice, so we'll be convening at 8. But be prepared to come back in later in the day if we need to.
Monday.
We are adjourned.